I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hello and welcome to Cinematic Universe, the podcast that you wouldn't like if we were angry. I'm your host, Joe Cunningham, and joining me are...
James Hunt.
And Andrew Ellard.
Andrew, thank you for joining us. Thank you for rejoining us.
Not at all. Third time. It's just the third time.
So previously, Batman Forever, was it?
Batman Forever and Kingsman.
Yes, of course.
Kingsman.
Which brings back traumatic memories.
I've never seen it. And hope to keep it that way.
I saw that the sequel had popped up on streaming recently, and I was tempted because I haven't seen it, but I wasn't tempted enough to actually do it.
Yeah, James, they're going to keep making them until you see one. It's kind of a threat now.
You're going to make The King's Man.
The King's Man, exactly.
So, today we will be discussing Ang Lee's 2003 movie Hulk. But before that, as we are doing at the start of these episodes at the moment, Andrew, you obviously knew Seb, and we would like to, you know, take a bit of time to talk about Seb and the relationship you had with him, because I know that the pair of you, I think it's fair to say, were equally fond of each other.
I hope so. I never get to ask him now, which seems preposterous. that's the thing that makes that's so unreasonable, because I remember, James, you were saying on the podcast before about his worry about whether people were enjoying what he was doing, and I think we all have that, like, that seems common. And I kind of figured, like, well, the way we were getting on, surely we were fine. But you never get to ask the question. And then you, in retrospect, you're just like, oh, I could have just said it. I've spent, I can't tell you, so much time in DMs in the last few weeks telling people how brilliant I think they are. Very deliberately and specifically, because they need to bloody know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's good. Like, I feel like that's good. That's a positive influence. It's a very funny thing. Seb was at my wedding, and Seb was part of the Ellard Oki karaoke group. That was a small band of us, a very small band of us, kind of at most there were 10 people in it, but not usually all at once, who would go to do it was Lucky Voice in Soho, the booth karaoke where you hire the room.
Yes.
And I mean, Seb was a tyrant in the best possible, like, he was running the playlist order, and you
this
might
is
as well...
one of the things that I didn't know about Seb until, unfortunately, after he passed, but seeing that video of him performing karaoke that I think
I was about to say
friend Simon Renshaw shared.
Yeah. Oh man,
there's a video on YouTube of Seb doing National Express.
Yeah. Oh, it's such a staple of his.
Which was, I mean, do you know about Karaoke Circus, Andrew?
It
was
performed. I did Meatloaf at Karaoke Circus.
Oh wow!
So for anyone who doesn't know, it was like a comedy night thing in London where comedians and members of the public used to alternate doing karaoke with a full band.
It's amazing! It's a great night.
I really miss it. But one of the one of the months it was held at a place called Ginglick, which was a converted public lavatory in Shepherd's Bush. And Seb did National Express, and I can't remember if he was before or immediately after Tim Minchin.
But
he shared the stage with Tim Minchin doing the Supernaturals. It was such a great night. It's on YouTube if you want to go find it.
And I think you know, talking about one of those effects, Andrew, I'm always the kind of person who, like, last time I was in a bar and someone said to me, "Are you going to get up and do the karaoke?" I was like, "Hell no." Like, as well, and even in the back of my head going, it probably would be fun if you get over the initial, and I'm just like, no. And I can promise to myself that next time I'm in that situation, I'll be doing it.
Grasp the nettle, man. You gotta do it. I did a I'm sure everybody was doing this, but I did a search of Twitter for, like, conversations I had with Seb, because I've got, like, all the old DMs and emails and stuff, but funnily enough, a lot of his interactions were held in public, and I went and had a look, and one of the things I found was him fantasy casting him and me for a remake of Little Shop of Horrors, so that he could be Seymour and I could be the plant, and we'd finally, because again, that was a karaoke staple of ours, and now they're talking about a remake.
Oh God!
It's actually been spoken about, and I seem to remember my first thought wasn't, "Oh, for crying out loud!" Like, there was something, I forget what the specifics of it were now, but I seem to remember it was like, "Oh, that maybe that could be okay." Except it's going to be a CGI plant, and I can't live with it not being a puppet.
Mm.
I had a similar experience, Andrew. I was we were looking through this first batch of episodes that we're doing, and there was one of the movies, and I was like, I wonder if there is anyone that is particularly passionate about this movie that we know, and it turned out that there was, and that was good. You'll likely hear that on an upcoming episode, listeners, but you know, unsurprisingly, the person's name who popped up the most talking about this superhero movie was Seb. It was a decade's worth of Seb mentioning it every 6 months or so. and I just thought, how you can't be surprised by that.
No. It's the most extraordinary. I mean, it's the most extraordinary thing, because you keep finding out that he was into Bill and Ted. So, of course, the guy who co-writes Bill and Ted likes him, knows him and likes him. And he does Red Dwarf stuff. So, of course, the guy who's running Red Dwarf knows him and likes him. It's this constant realization that everything he got enthusiastic about... I don't understand how the makers of The American Office never got in touch. I had one of those podcasts left when he died, and I shored it up for a week or so before I listened to it. And it's just... I'm totally ready for the next episode of that. Desperately unreasonable of him to just pack in the podcast as well as dying.
I still don't. I keep thinking I would like to listen to... I'd probably listen to maybe like a half, two-thirds of the episodes of this podcast that I wasn't on. And I still haven't quite been able to click those back on. And similarly, you know, I don't know about you guys, but like... There are certain pieces of pop culture which I just know, you know, that I'm not going to be able to view through the same lens ever again. And
yeah,
there's a lot of them, I'm sure eventually that will, you know, it won't be a negative thing. It will become a positive thing, and you know, a nice way to remember Seb and think about, you know, think back to the many, many things he will have said about them. But you know, Bill and Ted, Red Dwarf are absolutely some of those, that the Truman Show, and
yeah,
I mean they're countless. Fortunately, we were talking about a movie today that the reason I think one of the reasons it took us so long to get around to this is that Seb wasn't keen, and I think that spoiler alert, James, you're not massively keen either.
I am not massively keen.
So
here we go.
Yeah, I think we're going to have an interesting discussion once we get to Hulk.
I'm open to be convinced. I'll tell you that much. But
I'll take that. I will take that small half open door.
Right, I'm looking forward to it. So, is there anything else you want to say there, Andrew, or should we?
No, not really. I'll tell you what, actually, there's one thing that really irritates me, which is that Seb was talking about Ghost World. He posted a photo of the two leads of Ghost World and said, name me a better comedy, I'll wait. And I sent him a picture of the two leads of Booksmart, which in some ways is a bit of an ancestor of that movie. And which I hadn't realised was a bit of an ancestor of that movie until that moment. And I sent it to him and loads of people clicked like on my reply. So I got this response from him saying, well, now I'm going to have to go and watch this just based on the likes. And I think that's probably a week before he died. And now Olivia Wilde is in the running for a superhero movie.
She signed on. We just don't know which one. I think
rumor is Spider-Woman, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right.
But I think certainly a female-focused Spider character. That's almost guaranteed. The trades were reporting maybe Spider-Woman, which makes you think they know it's right. Spider-Woman.
So, like, that's right in the nexus of a conversation we were due to have.
Yeah.
Damn it.
Yeah. I just keep going back to it not being fair. It's not fair.
Yeah. No. Oh, I spent the first fortnight just furious. Just actively angry the whole time. Because it's an unreasonable piece of behaviour by the universe. But, I mean, I can't remember what I was watching the other night and the people were talking about, you know, the work that you leave behind, the art that you leave behind, the things that you do. What a body of work. And it's a body of work about other people's work. Like, it's not even look at me. It's look at all this cool stuff.
Yeah.
God, I mean, if any of us have a half-decent legacy after all of this nonsense life that we have lived. You couldn't do much better.
I just talking passionately about such an array of different things as if no one's listening and not really caring whether they are, just because I think Seb would, you know, be delighted to know that he had tweeted about something that then someone went off and went, oh yeah, I then watched that and that was amazing. But I think it would be enough for him for just to put those vibes out into the universe, you know?
You know, it's such a thing of, because so many people now, they make a YouTube channel or whatever and it's done with calculation. It's like, I know I need to find a niche in the market for this to be worth doing because I need the advertising revenue from it. And bum, 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 bum. And it's totally reasonable to find a business model if that's your thing. But what his was, I like this stuff. There must be other people out there who like this stuff. Well, let's just keep making the podcast. Let's keep talking about the American Office until people find me. And that was enough.
And listen, Andrew, the SEO has been telling us that we need to get after Ang Lee's 2003 movie Hulk for a while now. And that's a calculation that we felt we had to make.
Oh, I'm going to disappoint everybody.
It's been on our list for a long time, but yeah, we...
Guys, I've been on the end of the phone. I've been available. if you're looking for an advocate for the movie, I'm right here. Oh no, spoilers, but yeah, too late.
I advocated talking about this movie on the podcast a number of times and tried to put it onto the schedule back in the very early days. And it was just like, no, look, there's so many more things we can get to before that.
Right.
And we've got here, and I think I had actually, I'd never watched it. And when we started doing the podcast, I was like, I'm going to wait to watch that until we do it. So I've only watched it for
5 or 6 years.
Genuinely. And I bought the DVD in preparation. So the DVD has been sat in my cupboard for a few years as well.
Oh my God.
And I've actively restrained myself. Finally in the last, well, I watched it a few weeks ago and then popped on the Ang Lee commentary in the last couple of days just to refresh myself.
Oh, marvellous.
Okay, so what we are going to do now is have a quick chat about the pop culture that we've been consuming in the last few weeks before we get to that Hulk discussion. Andrew, do you want to go first? What's been pushing your pop culture buttons recently?
Do you know what? I've had a very good couple of weeks with television that behaves how television should behave. So,
you know what? I think I know what you mean by that.
We'll find out. you may or may not be aware that I really didn't like the Marvel Netflix shows.
Join the club.
Get jackets made, because it's so infuriating to sit and watch them not quite do anything for an hour and then throw in a cliffhanger to make you come back. And it's not, people talk about it like, oh, it's a movie and it's chopped up into 10 pieces. It's not a movie.
They certainly weren't. Do you remember, Andrew, the worst offender for me of that was, I think it was an end of a season one episode of Luke Cage, and he gets shot up and like pushed into the back of a garbage truck.
He gets
and
then thrown
And you're like, oh, God, what's going to happen? He's going to get crushed. At the start of the next episode, he just stands up and gets out of it.
He literally, the next episode, he climbs out and walks away.
Yeah. The worst thing about that as well is that that episode then ends with the same cliffhanger of him getting shot.
Yes.
And it's just like, we literally just saw it. It doesn't matter.
Very, very bad. I think the guy in charge of that Marvel TV stuff was in charge of Heroes, if I got that right.
And it was Jeff Loeb who was doing the Marvel TV stuff, and yeah, he did work on Heroes.
Right. And you can see how there's sort of like an antecedent there for not quite handling this correctly.
Yeah, I mean, I really loved Daredevil, and I liked the other Marvel shows to varying degrees, but generally I found them a frustrating watching experience, that's for sure. Yeah. And I mean, that's true of a lot of streaming things. It's true of Stranger Things as well.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Oh,
and there's a Film Crit Hulk did an amazing piece on plot blocking in the first series of Stranger Things, where literally they'll all head out to do something, have an argument, and go home, so that in the next episode they can head out and do the same thing again. It's awful. And this is the thing. So the thing that's bothered me for ages about streaming is this, oh, just keep doing one tone and we'll chop it into separate pieces and punt it out like it's a show, because the job is to keep you watching. It's not to make separate individual crafted episodes of television. But I feel like that might be being pushed back against at last, because I've seen three things in the last couple of weeks that have given me a lot of hope. And one of them is Lovecraft Country, which is just brilliantly episodic. Like, it's all interconnected and it's doing its own thing, and I think we're four episodes in, but every episode is its own little mini movie. That's one.
Andrew, I think it bears mentioning that one of the stars of that, Jonathan Majors, has recently been announced as Kang in the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
There you go.
it all ties together.
It all ties together.
Also starring Jurnee Smollett from Birds of Prey.
Yes. It's a really good cast. It's a really well-made show. It knows exactly what it's saying. I apologise for citing it on this podcast, but it has got a relationship to the Watchmen show that happened in terms of things that it's dealing with, and dealing with impressively. So that's going on. And then completely separately and very differently, but not really, Cobra Kai is on Netflix now.
Yeah. I saw it had come to Netflix. It used to be on YouTube Red, didn't it?
That's right. Yes. So the spin-off from The Karate Kid, and they are nailing it. It's the most extraordinary thing, not only from it's actually proper episodes of television point of view, where it's an ongoing story, but each one has a moment that will either make you punch the air or cry. Like, every episode, they're finding one. But on top of all of that, it's threading this incredible needle with the tone of the show, where it's definitely a bit of a parody. But it's not so much of a parody that you don't take the emotions and the characters seriously.
I want to spin off on two things of that, Andrew. Because how far are you in? Because we've just finished the first season.
Yeah, Cobra Kai, halfway through season two.
Right, okay. So I think, it is fascinating that this has happened again with a TV show that has been out in the world for literally years, and it is showing up on Netflix, which should just tell you, should tell a lot of content producers that the accessibility of something is super important.
Yes.
And just get it in front of people, get good storytelling in front of people, and, you know, the sky's the limit.
Yeah. I mean, that's the problem, isn't it? It was on YouTube Red, and who is subscribing to YouTube Red?
Absolutely.
No one.
It's funny because YouTube feels ubiquitous. You can feel like when you say, oh yeah, I literally go to at least one YouTube video every single day. And that's true, but you don't hand Google your credit card number when you do it.
Yeah. It's interesting, is it? Because I would have... And you know what? I remember when it first debuted on YouTube Red and hearing good things about it. I seem to remember Alan Sepinwall tweeting about it and going, yeah, oh, that's interesting. I wonder if I'll get around to it.
Yeah, YouTube, my brother really sold it to me as well. Like, he loved The Karate Kid and he was going like, yeah, it's great. It's really good. But I didn't watch it because it was on YouTube Red.
Yeah, no, of course not.
And then the other thing I wanted to ask you... I was stunned from the first episode by quite how quietly great a performance William Zabka was giving as Johnny Lawrence, who is, I love that performance. I love everything about it. Is it that Ralph Macchio is just bad by comparison, or is he just bad?
Oh, I mean, look, he's a child actor who's making the best of the ability that it had. There are some people who, you know, they hit the right age for performances that the audiences find credible, truthful, believable, that they invest in, and then they age out of it. Like, it's like how, you know, hard it is to find a De Niro performance that isn't a bit of a joke now.
He Macaulay Culkin'd himself.
Well, yeah. You know, and it's, if you're lucky, your good ages are 25 to 55. but for some people, it's a very brief... Like, nobody thinks Haley Joel Osment, the adult, is a terrific actor. And when he turns up in cameos and does little performances in things...
It's fun.
It's fine. But for some reason, he was a super believable child.
Yeah.
And that's
Say, Andrew, I just want to speak up briefly for Robert De Niro in The Intern.
Okay.
I think he's quite good in The Intern. That's the only one I can think of recently. I mean, obviously The Irishman, but it's an old man.
It's worth also saying though that De Niro on his best day, anybody on their best day could not be Ralph Macchio in front of a camera right now. Like, you to be the Karate Kid, you have to feel like, oh, that's the kid from The Karate Kid, only old and with his face slightly lifted. Like, nobody else can do that. And I think there's a strange value even in that. You know?
Oh, no, there is. It's not something that breaks the show by any means.
Oh, no.
And I don't watch the scenes with him in and go, Jesus Christ, what this is unwatchable. I think it oddly works in the show's favour that early on you're like, maybe Johnny was the hero. I don't know if you ever watched How I Met Your Mother, Andrew.
I'm aware of the episode, yeah.
Yeah, there's like kind of a mini arc, I think, over a few episodes where Barney, who his whole shtick is he's the worst, basically, watched The Karate Kid as a kid and was just convinced that Johnny Lawrence was the hero and doesn't understand anyone that could read it the other way. And the fact that there's an episode early on where Johnny retells the events of The Karate Kid from his perspective, and you're sat there going, he hasn't told a lie.
It's so good. That show is such a good constant exercise in perspective, and like to clarify, because in the 80s, you know, it's the kind of movie where there are villains and straightforward good guys, but actually to go, yeah, but to end up a villain, you probably were a good guy who joined a karate club and then things turned bad.
Yeah, so that's we've got Lovecraft Country, we've got Cobra Kai.
Oh, and the third one, and I know how ridiculous this is going to sound, but the Babysitter's Club.
I've heard good things about the reboot of the Babysitter's Club, right?
It's, you have heard correctly. Now, I have no cultural connection to the Babysitter's Club. My wife's American and is like, oh my God, it's just like the books. Like, she's very excited that this thing is back and doing it right. She's even happy that the logo of the show is correct. But again, in terms of doing, it's a lot like Cobra Kai in that it seems to manage to do a big laugh and a big gut-wrenching thing with every episode in a completely tied up and clean bit of storytelling. And I know it's not for me. I'm really aware that this is not television geared towards me specifically. But nonetheless, it's working really well.
That's good though. That is the mark of well-made TV, right? If it's not really your thing, but you kind of find yourself watching anyway,
and you're there
that's
anyway.
Why I watch
yeah.
Riverdale.
Ah.
Which is good because you get like four movies worth of content in every episode.
That's all you want, isn't it? I said on Twitter the other day, it's the nature of streaming shows is to hand you a very big steak and to keep make you chewing that steak episode after episode with exactly the same flavour. And what you want from television, the way box set culture grew up was from, okay, 24 and Prison Break, but also The West Wing. Like, a whole load of network shows where every episode was so satisfying, you immediately wanted another episode.
Yeah was it you who made that point, actually, on Twitter? Yeah, saying that, like, we didn't used to watch one story stretched across, you know, 10 hours. We watched Friends, and we watched, like, 10 episodes of Friends.
But that's what I find curious, right, is that two of the most valuable shows to, you know, that the streaming services are bidding over furiously every time the contract comes up are Friends and The American Office. And even stuff like Frasier and Seinfeld is still pretty valuable. And, you know, those are your prototypical sitcoms that have discrete stories with, you know, maybe some overarching plot lines running through them over the course of a season.
Yeah.
And yet, it's not just a drama problem that the streaming services have had problems with. You know, they've turned a lot of their comedies into this as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Can I just drag it around to comics, actually? Because
oh, please.
There was a similar thing, right? Which is that in the mid-2000s, early mid-2000s, Marvel especially decided that they were going to focus, like, the big money for comics was actually on the sort of long tail of bookstore sales. So they decided that instead of doing a single-ish story per issue, they were going to package storylines up into six-issue bunches.
Right.
So that they could sell a book further down the line. And what it meant was, like, just this sort of radical change in the way that comic stories were told, because suddenly you had this thing called decompression, which is that a story that would have previously taken an issue suddenly became more cinematic and a lot longer.
Yeah.
And it had exactly the same problems as you see in streaming now, which is that you would just be like, I read an issue, it took me 10 minutes to read, but nothing happened in it. I can't revisit it. And, like, suddenly long conversations that would have been three panels took six pages.
Absolutely.
Because authors were, like, trying to get you, you know, strung on the minute details, but not giving you substance in return.
I'm absolutely convinced that eventually that, like, one of the reasons the Netflix shows so often, you know, collapse after two seasons, it's that, right? It's that I don't really mind if I have more. I don't really care because I haven't been, I get that you've got me on this clever little carrot in front of me treadmill where I keep feeling like I'm moving forwards, mm-hmm. because you promise that, you know, this is mounting towards something, and the cliffhangers prove it, right? The cliffhangers at the end of one episode absolutely prove that there is movement. But actually, no, they're cycling back mostly to the start. The number of times in those Marvel shows where you ended up on the same three sets over and over and over again. And it's like, where's he gone? And it's like, well, he'll be on one of the two other sets that you have.
The thing I always noticed on the Marvel shows was how often they got the villain and the hero together so that they could have a conversation and then leave without having, like, the fight they needed to have.
So that they can have a conversation, right? Is so exactly what it is though. Yeah.
I always used to quite enjoy their practice of going, here's the villain, oh no, that villain's gone. Here's the real villain. Oh, yeah. It's kind of the same.
It's the same
deal
it's...
as the first one.
That's the thing. Like, there's a thing with in a look. Putting my script editor hat on for a second, because why wouldn't I have brought that
this
with
is,
me?
This is what I was hoping for.
If you get to a midpoint, the point of a midpoint isn't just to change so that things change. It's that they alter in a way that makes the situation even more interesting and dangerous than it was before. If you put one villain out and drop one new villain in, that nobody at home goes, oh, things have really changed. It's like, no, casting has really changed. The thing that now happens is that they go home and say, how are we going to deal with insert slightly different name?
Yeah.
Well, Andrew, hopefully you're right. Hopefully it is starting to move back in the right direction.
I love that I found several back-to-back. That gives me such hope.
James, what have you been reading, watching, listening to this week?
I've just finished watching the whole of Steven Universe from start to finish.
So I'll be honest with you, I'm aware of Steven Universe without necessarily knowing exactly what it is.
Ostensibly, it's a kids cartoon. It is a kids cartoon, but I would say all ages is fairer. It's all ages, but skews young, let's say that. It's about a kid who is half human, half alien, and the aliens are represented by gems. And so he's living in a beach house, the only half-human, half-gem in the universe. And he's got three gems who are refugees from an interstellar war and his dad. And it's just about him growing up and, you know, the legacy he has, because it turns out his gem was his mother's and she was the leader of this rebellion that happened in their society, and that's why they're all exiled on Earth. And it's a really interesting exploration of, like, identity and trauma, and it's so clever with the way it tells these stories, like, in a way that works for kids but is also actually pretty, like, adult and deals with real issues. Like, there's this thing they do which is called fusion, right? And fusion is two gems combining to make a different, more superpowered gem. Mm-hmm. But the way it's treated within the world of the show is it's kind of allegorical to sex. And there's this whole thing where someone is tricking the other gem into fusing with them because they enjoy the feeling of, like, fusing into the super gem.
Oh my god.
And they have, like, an argument about, like, how... about consent, basically. It's about sexual consent, but in a way that children can understand.
Oh, that's so smart.
And that was the episode that made me go, oh, actually, this is more interesting than I realised.
Another show that I've not watched, but is it kind of similar in its approach to Adventure Time?
I've not watched Adventure Time.
Okay. Well, in that case, ignore that question.
I believe that Rebecca Sugar, who created Steven Universe, actually came up through Adventure Time.
Right, okay. So see, there we go.
There
it
is
was
a relationship there, yeah.
Oh, I need to give this a look. I've been... this is ridiculous timing. I've been writing a science fiction kids TV show.
wow.
Which is my first go at kids TV. And it's like, you really do have to calculate hard and be very smart about how you articulate things. And I may not be smart enough. We'll find out. Clearly, I need to give this a look. This is exactly the kind of stuff I'm fascinated by.
Yeah. I mean, the thing I would say about Steven Universe is it has 10 minute episodes, and you start off thinking, like, okay, it's fairly sort of kiddie, but they build the lore over the course of, like, a season, and by season two, everything is suddenly piecing together in a much bigger way.
Wow.
It's really smart, because it kind of ages up with its audience as well. Like, the most recent series, like the sixth series, was called Steven Universe Future, and it's basically 20 episodes about the main character having PTSD.
Oh my god.
Like, it is so... like, he's become a teenager and he just can't handle, like, everything that he's been through as a child. Like, it's such an interesting and unique show. I've just never seen anything like it. I would highly recommend that everyone watches it and sticks with it.
And so is it six seasons in and still going, or is it...
No, that's the end. There are five seasons, a movie, and then the sixth season, and that's it for now.
Wait, they did six seasons and a movie. Oh, how bright. How am I going to miss this? Okay.
Okay, so I would like to pivot to have a quick chat about Adam Sandler. So I don't know where you guys what your kind of view is on Adam Sandler.
I mean, I was literally walking out the door, so
so I kind of have like film projects on the go at any one time, like a number of different ones where I'm like either working my way through a franchise or.
I thought you were about to say that you'd cast him in something. Yes, he was available, he'll do anything and, these days.
So I've lured Sandler away from Netflix and he's and he's starring in something for me. I might be like watching a certain director's filmography or a particular actor, as is the case here. Or I kind of have my larger projects where like over the course of a year, each year I try and watch a movie from each year over the past 100 years, because that's something that it kind of in the letterboxed age is possible to do and keep track of, and it makes me happy. But yeah, so I've been rewatching Adam Sandler movies, kind of inspired by thinking he was incredible in Uncut Gems at the end of last year, and kind of being the right age when I was a teenager to grow up on the kind of first wave of Happy Madison movies. But not having watched them for a long time. So my wife and I have watched... we've watched Billy Madison, Happy Gilmore, Bulletproof, The Wedding Singer, The Waterboy, Big Daddy, and Little Nicky so far. So we're just watching Adam Sandler starring vehicles rather than his other stuff. And it's fair to say that they're a real mixed bag, but...
is that what's fair to say? Okay.
But... And also the aspects of them have, as you could probably expect, aged particularly badly. Especially given that a lot of Sandler's early work was kind of... I think that the kindest way you could put it is that some of his characters appear to have learning difficulties or being on the verge of some kind of diagnosis.
I love how reasonable you're being about all of this.
Yeah. And like particularly in like I'm thinking of The Waterboy and Billy Madison in particular and Little Nicky as well. But I kind of have a weird respect for Adam Sandler's career, in spite of how many terrible movies he has made over the course of it, because I think there are gems, and you know, within that I think there's some really great stuff in Billy Madison and in Happy Gilmore. I think he's really, really great in The Wedding Singer.
Yes.
Again, it's not a fantastic movie start to finish, but I think he gives a pretty good performance in Big Daddy. I think a movie that if you remove a few of the Happy Madison ticks from, could have been a real big, huge kind of crossover success. But again, it just hasn't aged particularly well. So that's a problem. But I love that he knows that he has the capacity to give the kind of performances he does in the likes of Punch Drunk Love and Uncut Gems. But kind of does every kind of. Funny People, which I think is a very imperfect movie, starring Eric Bana, who we're about to talk a lot about. But I think he's pretty great in it. And that is a movie that pretty much diagnoses the Sandler career and goes, like, you're so, so talented. You're such a funny guy. Why do you keep making this shit? And he literally goes from Funny People to... making Grown Ups Just Go With It, and then The Nadir, which is Jack and Jill. Which is, Jack and Jill is the movie that you could put in as one of the fake movies from Funny People. You and your childhood friend Judd Apatow have just diagnosed your career, and you've doubled down and done it again. I love is that we've got a comedic actor who is capable of giving these great dramatic performances, who is clearly a talented comedian. And I think for a number of interesting reasons, keeps 25 years into his career churning out comedy year in, year out. And I have a weird respect.
Yeah, I was going to say, comedy is a generous way of describing his most recent films.
But...
I'll be honest. What I was hoping for was that you were going to go, I've been through the man's entire body of work, and here's the interesting thing. There is a shape to it. There is a real genius, and here's the one film that nobody talks about that actually, if you look at it through the right lens, is the most extraordinary piece of work. But the problem is...
But I'm hoping I'm going to get to that shortly, because I think I know what that is, and if my memory serves me correct, it's You Don't Mess With the Zohan. So I will make sure to report back.
Okay, alright.
He's pretty open, right? He makes movies in... exotic places around the world, because they're the places he would like to go on holiday. He goes on those holidays with all of his friends, and kind of keeps his friends in work. And
it's like a charity. I see what you're saying.
Yeah, well, and I kind of like that commitment to, I'm just going to keep doing this stuff because people keep watching it and I enjoy making them. And
so what you're saying is you respect the contempt he has for the people who have to then watch his, like, extended jollies on screen.
But I also like that peppered in between those, every few years, you get an Uncut Gems. Yes. And, you know, you get the Meyerowitz stories. You get It's Not Good, but you get Men, Women and Children. It's Not Good, but you get The Cobbler, which, you know, the director of that wins... Best Picture at the Oscars the year after.
I kind of see what you're saying in that what he's essentially doing is doing a first draft over and over and over again. But every so often, the fact that he's done so many rubbish first draft movies has polished him enough that he has the ability to do Punch Drunk Love, Uncut Gems, or things like Wedding Singer and even 50 First Dates, like the good stuff.
But I also think that occasionally, and again, I will get to these when I revisit, I think occasionally those naff comedies are better than the reputation they have because they now just get all grouped together. And there's a lot that, I watched Murder Mystery that was his big Netflix movie from last year. It's not good, but it was nowhere near as bad as its reputation.
Right.
And I think as well that sometimes... Well, a lot of the times he's giving good performances in movies that are otherwise would be solid comedies, but have enough of that kind of Happy Madison unpleasantness sprinkled through them that people just go, nope. So it'll be the end of a solid scene and then there'll be a cutaway to something naff and unpleasant and you just go, eh, all right. And also he's made the Hotel Transylvania trilogy in the past decade, which are, as far as I'm concerned, really solid kids movies.
It's nice that, because you don't have to do a lot of work to get those. That's just voice work.
It's him and all his mates.
You don't get to go on holiday though.
That's true. No, there's no. Yeah, he roughed it for us. He went to just a regular studio near his home. So think about that. Now, I tell you what, Joe. There's a thing that I think Richard Curtis said years ago about how there's no point him making rom-coms for the people who don't like Richard Curtis movies. Like, there's just no point, because they're never going to like them. And that's fair enough. So he makes his movies for the kind of people who like the movies he makes. And that's what we're saying about Adam Sandler, right? Is because you exist, these movies exist. And the rest of us are just going to have to put up with that.
And I genuinely don't think that Adam Sandler has a contempt for his audience. I think he still finds what he's doing funny.
Yes, I think you might be right. I think he might consider them comedies.
And I also really like him on Twitter. He's got a really sweet Twitter persona.
Oh, that helps. That does help. So, why does that help? It is true. That does help.
It wasn't just Uncut Gems last year. It was Uncut Gems followed by his awards speech. I think it was the Independent Spirit.
The awards speech was very good.
Which he did in the voice of Bobby Boucher from The Waterboy. And then he had a really sweet tweet the day that he didn't get nominated for the Oscar for Uncut Gems, which honestly I think is criminal. He would have been my winner last year. But he was like, so the Sandman didn't get nominated, but Mama Boucher did, because Kathy Bates had been nominated for the Clint Eastwood movie. And he was like, and he was just delighted for Kathy Bates, again, 20 years after they made The Waterboy together.
Oh,
Which is sweet, right?
Yeah.
I like Adam Sandler is what I'm saying, in spite of everything. And, I mean, who knows how far down this rabbit hole I'll get, because it is going to get challenging.
In fairness, I did, when I was a teenager, and probably even now, I liked Billy Madison, Happy Gilmore, and The Wedding Singer. And then I felt like he did the Farrelly Brothers thing of doing those things, but more so to the point where it became really grating. Like, I love Dumb and Dumber, but every subsequent Farrelly Brothers movie went, oh, well, we've guessed what you liked about those, so here's more gross and extreme jokes. And it's like, no. I like again, the gentle version of that.
Of course, James, that is the case until one of them went off and won Best Picture at the Oscars.
Wait, what was that?
Green Book.
Green Book.
Was that one of them? Holy shit.
Yeah. That's Peter Farrelly.
Wow.
Well, that's why his politics were so good.
Do you know what? I used to adore There's Something About Mary when I was younger. Yeah. And I am terrified of ever watching that again. Because I just know it's going to be one of those that I go, oh.
Yes. The thing I remember is Me, Myself and Irene.
Oh.
And so,
that was when it tipped, I think.
Yeah, that I remember watching that in the cinema going like, I don't think this racism is as funny as you think it is.
Right, on that note, I think we've done a good job about talking about the things we've been watching. Do you know what? I'm kind of happy I didn't fully win you round on Adam Sandler. It's nice to be in this box on my own.
I gotta say, I mean, I brought out the Babysitter's Club and I thought I was reaching a bit. And then you've totally got me covered. Like, I look reasonable in comparison.
You should see my wife's face after we're watching something. Like, she'll turn to me after The Wedding Singer and go like, yeah, that was actually really good. And Big Daddy, she was like, yeah, it was fine. And then Little Nicky ended and she was like, why?
I mean, I tell you what, she must love you a great deal.
Well, the next two, we've got a double bill of Punch Drunk Love and Mr. Deeds. So,
oh, there you go. Okay,
let's see how that holds up.
The whiplash of that will be interesting, if nothing.
Yes, yeah, as I can imagine, it was for cinema audiences.
Absolutely.
Back in.
Absolutely.
And before we move on to Hulk, Andrew, you have a Kickstarter that we need to talk about.
Oh yes, so I. I got very, very keen on doing something for me for once, or at least rather something for an audience that I just put out there into the world in exactly the way we've sort of been talking about. And so for years, people have been asking me to explain why it is that I think it's reasonable to suggest that Quantum of Solace is anything other than a terrible film. Because I see so much in that movie, and it's not that it has no fans, and there are plenty of fans sort of in James Bond fandom that get it, but I feel like there's a lot of texture to that movie and a lot of interesting things that movie is saying and doing that people don't grapple with. And I started doing a set of tweet notes on the movie thinking, good, this will explain my point. And I wanted to explain it really well, so I went and did screen grabs from the film. But after four scenes, I had hundreds of screen grabs. So apparently I had more to say and Twitter was not going to be the medium for this. So I kind of grasped the nettle and went, right, I will do a video. And I tried a little experiment with it and joined together this interesting thing that's going on in Quantum of Solace, where there's three different scenes where characters are dragged from car boots and they all kind of tell the key aspects of the story each time, and nobody seems to have noticed this. And that bit went down quite well on Twitter, so it's like, all right, well then I'll go and get a proper editor to do this properly, because I'm a terrible editor. So Nathan Cubitt, who's been my editor on the Red Dwarf documentaries before he took over directing them, is going to edit them, and we're going to get them made in time for No Time to Die coming out in cinemas, assuming No Time to Die comes out in cinemas. So the idea is to do Quantum of Solace, and then for the stretch goals, you can also get me to do the other Daniel Craig Bond movies. So we'll see how this goes, but I'm hoping people will be interested enough to pay for it to happen.
I tell you who will be interested enough, and that's Joe.
Yes. Andrew and I have, well, I've tweeted out petty things about Quantum of Solace before, which Andrew has challenged me on.
Oh, yes.
And I haven't watched it for long enough that I could reasonably debate with Andrew. I just remember back at the time, and I've probably only revisited it maybe once since then, finding it very suborned in its action, and just as someone who adored Casino Royale, feeling let down by the way that that story was tied up and wrapped up in Quantum of Solace. But, you know,
Let me sell you on it.
I desperately want to see this rebuttal.
I promise it'll be worth it, because it's not that I'm saying the movie's perfect, and like, you just have to ignore all the things that are wrong with it. And in fact, what's wrong with it is something I really want to talk about in the video. And in fact, it'll be true of, I think, all of them, because one of the things that happened with the Bonds was they went, let's get high caliber directors. So the thing with high caliber directors is they want to stamp their taste and tone all over the movie. And there comes a point where instead of doing what the script wants, you're like fighting it. And when that works well, you get Skyfall. You get a movie that basically goes down really well because James Bond being a resurrected hero is quite a good theme. Yeah. And when it goes badly, you have, I don't know, James Bond's got like a long lost stepbrother and he's also the villain for some reason. Like, oh, and God. Oh, James, I was the author of all your pain. Which, when? When does that fit into anything that we've seen? So, but there's a nice battle going on there, I think, and that makes the conversation about those movies interesting. And with Quantum of Solace, it's, he's a bullet. I'm going to direct him like James Bond is a bullet charging towards stuff. And you go, okay, what's the story about? Oh, it's about how everyone mistakes him for a really angry bullet, but actually he's completely hollowed out now and he's all about duty and he doesn't care about revenge at all. Wait a second, that style doesn't go with that story. And at the crux of that are two really interesting approaches to a Bond film that shouldn't necessarily go together, but absolutely are worth talking about.
Well, I look forward to it. Listeners, definitely we'll tweet out the link with this episode, and I highly encourage you to help make that happen. Okay, guys, Hulk.
Look at you. Off to college to be a great scientist.
Like your father.
There's something inside you so special. Someday you're gonna share it with the whole world.
Let's hit the gamma radiation.
Countdown started.
Gamma meds released.
I don't understand what I just saw.
It's like the gamma released something that was already there.
My son is unique, and the world will not tolerate his existence.
What did you do to me?
I improved on nature a million times more powerful.
My God. Everything we have to stop his movement.
You will only fuel his rage and make him stronger.
You know I never hurt you.
When you're left with no choice,
I'm sending her a surprise visit from some friends of mine.
When you're pushed too far,
you pathetic freak.
Don't just get even, you're making me angry. Get mad.
I don't think you're gonna like me when I'm angry.
And unleash the hero within. From director Ang Lee.
We're gonna have to watch that temper of yours.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Before Shopify, were you wondering, where are my sales at? Now you're selling with Shopify, the global commerce platform supercharging your selling. You have no problem selling online, in person, on social media, and beyond. Gary, easy on the cha-ching.
Oh, sorry, but my Shopify sales are through the roof.
Start selling with Shopify today and discover how millions of businesses around the world use Shopify to ignite their selling. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/listen. Shopify.com/listen.
Hulk. Not the Hulk, just Hulk.
Just Hulk.
Just Hulk.
We go back to 2003, when the comic book movie revival had just kind of just fully announced itself, right? So we've had X-Men and we've had Spider-Man, and James Seamus tells a very funny story about how, like, he was he walked out of Spider-Man and rung up Ang Lee and said, "We're fucked." because this genre has baggage now. It has been, like, superhero is a genre now. Hmm. And I hadn't really thought about it in those terms before, but of course we'd had superhero movies so much, but, like, I maybe not superhero as a genre, but Marvel is a genre. And suddenly this Hulk movie that is is going about things, I think it's fair to say, and I think you will both agree with this, in a very different way to what we've certainly been accustomed to since with superhero cinema, but definitely with X-Men and Spider-Man, you know, which are two movies that I like, but this is doing something very different. What we've got, and I kind of would like to know your kind of overarching thoughts on the movie before we get into it in detail, but what we've got is this very odd little curio of a superhero movie that I feel like doesn't really get talked about much anymore, but after watching it, I feel like it should.
Go on, James.
I'll start with the stuff I like about the movie, right? And that is that it is very respectful of the character. And it reminds me quite a lot of Batman Begins, in that Ang Lee looked at this and went, okay, so if this was real, how would it happen? And how would it work? And I got some shades of, like, the early Superman movies, where they were, like, especially the first one, where it does, like, the life story aspect. Mm-hmm. So I can see what Ang Lee was going for. And clearly he had a visual style in mind, and, you know, I appreciate that. My problem is the whole film itself is just so, so dull. Like, I just sit there, like, bored out of my skull going, when is any of this going to make sense? When are things going to happen?
So I think what I can probably do is provide the bridge from James's opinion through to Andrew's. I kind of think that this is a fascinating approach to telling this story that I think I find much more interesting than I actually find entertaining while I'm watching it. I love Ang Lee's approach to the filmmaking. I love the, you know, the attempt at every second to make it feel like a comic book. This movie should have been nominated for Best Editing, because some of those transitions are just gorgeous. And I for me, it is the it's the psychological Batman Begins. It's Batman Begins, mm-hmm. but what if all of it is just focusing on how did, well, also Bruce, how did Bruce feel in Crime Alley? And
Just doing his trauma for an entire 2 hours.
Yeah. And so it's a movie that goes, okay, we want to tell the story of the Hulk. So what would drive someone to, you know, aside from the comic book stuff, where someone's like rage and inner turmoil manifest itself in a big green monster? And then attaches that to a Hulk origin story and figures it out that way. I think that it doesn't ultimately come together as kind of like an entertaining piece of blockbuster filmmaking is that A, the technology is not quite there in 2003 to do the Hulk properly. Although not that I think he looks bad. I just think that it's not quite there. And the
reviews at the time were very, oh my god, this is a step up again. Like what were we, Gollum and stuff, I think.
Yes, I mean I don't think this is anywhere near Gollum. I don't know. I don't know what you think.
I was fascinated by, like, the Empire review at the time was like, yeah, this is the next step forward for digital characters. Like, there was no, oof, we're not really there yet, are we? We can't do this yet. That wasn't the prevailing opinion.
Yeah. And do you know what? I think, like, the physics of the character work, I think the... I think he does ultimately end up looking a bit too plastic, but the physics of the character, the movement, you know, everyone will have seen the kind of the viral content of Ang Lee performing the onset Hulk, which is, you know, fascinating to watch, to know that this is how invent, because I think for a lot of people they kind of go like, oh, that's Ang Lee's kind of like sellout movie that he made for the studios, and it's just really not that thing, is it?
No, it's patently not that.
But then, yeah, I come back to the surface of it being, I think whenever the movie is indoors, it looks really dull. And I more mean like the sets that I just find a little bit draining, like the artificial houses and the labs. I just don't find them a hugely fun place to spend a movie.
And then, the characters, though. Like, just all well, of it.
Not... and then, not the characters, but for me, Eric Banner's performance. And I'm going to let Andrew go in a second. And then the third thing is the dogs. So, Andrew, go.
Hey, you came after the dogs.
Hulkhounds.
Oh, God, I love those dogs. right, well, the dogs are from the comics, right? That is a thing, but...
Are they, though?
Aren't they, though? I'll be honest, I only looked at Wikipedia.
There were hulking dogs, but I think they turn up after the movie.
Oh, interesting. Oh, that's interesting, because one of the writers gives an interview where he says, oh, this writer added the dogs, but he took those from the comics.
There is a real tendency to blame anything shitty on comics, and I often resent it.
Why would you need to do that for this excellent movie?
I can't be certain whether they turned up in the comics or not before the movie. Okay. But certainly they're not used in this way.
It was in the comics is not a good argument for a thing being good or bad.
No, right. Sirius the Gamma Dog appeared in a 1984... He's a very minor Hulk character who appeared in a 1984 storyline.
I mean, so just as a quick tangent, I came out of League of Extraordinary Gentlemen and someone went, well, you can't blame the story for being stupid because it was adapted from a comic and I just wanted to throttle that person.
No, that's reasonable. That's entirely reasonable. Nobody would have prosecuted you for that.
But yeah.
No, look, I do. I like the dogs. I think the dogs represent a manner of think through, which is it makes complete sense that this science obsessed father gets hold of finds out his son is becoming this thing and says, oh, that's kind of what I'd been working towards in the first place. I mean, not really, but it's mad enough and brilliant enough. And tries to get hold of it and then tests on whatever he can get hold of, which, of course, is a few stray dogs, which he's been keeping and feeding. And, you know, and because he has no particular interest in ethics or anybody being okay, of course he tests on animals and doesn't think twice about how awful what he's done to those dogs is.
You see, I think it tracks, and when you were there, when you were saying then, I like the dogs because they represent, I was thinking, that's what I feel like most of this movie. I like this because of it, what it represents, but then I do have to watch 5 to 10 minutes of the Hulk fighting dogs.
And if it's three, I'll be surprised. But I like him fighting the dogs. I think that's exactly, like, it's really hard. That Hulk is one of the, not unlike Superman, Hulk is one of those superpowered characters that's really hard to give an enemy to because of their innate power. But the nice thing is, the Hulk is still a newborn at this point, but the dogs are, in theory, the dog version of him. So it's like a regular guy fighting off three angry dogs. Like, the balance of that is quite good. And I will say, I enjoy that fight. I like how you can tell when they're defeated, because, like in a video game, they go poof, green.
But
I realise that's also a bad thing. But
the first moment where he smashes his Hulk fist down into one of the dogs, and it bursts up green. In a way, I was relieved, but I was so disgusted because I was like, he's just pummeled a dog.
Yeah, he's just pummeled a dog. It's but just, a Hulk dog.
It's just, I just, I'll be honest, I found that sequence unpleasant to watch.
I mean, but I don't think that's entirely accidental. No. I think there's a definite, I mean, actually, if you look at the opening title sequence where it's cutting up starfish,
ooh, yeah,
and like, there is a definite, and for want of a better term, and probably this is racist, but there is a sort of Eastern approach. I'm sure having a Taiwanese director brings with it that kind of, like, I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is like Old Boy and the Squid. But like the different relationship with how you treat living things and how willing you are to cut them up, if it's food or for the benefit of science or whatever. Like, there's a way that stuff is both handled and photographed that Hollywood would normally not go anywhere near.
It is. It's very visceral, and it has that sort of body horror aspect.
Yeah,
that is fair. I just,
that's
it. It's not a pleasant thing to watch, and I feel like if you're going to make a Hulk movie, you can't. Much in the same way that Josh Trank's body horror version of Fantastic Four was a bad idea. Yeah. Like, if you want to make a body horror movie, maybe don't track it back to this comic book character originally aimed at kids.
No, that's perhaps fair. Maybe it is the Cronenberg fan in me that's actually quite digging the whole thing.
But you know what, weirdly, I like the stuff with the animals, because it does, that sounds weird, but it does feel, it feels quite sciencey and true, and it is true to the characters. And not that the dogs isn't, but like, it's the fact that like Hulk still is ostensibly the hero. And seeing him pound those dogs to death, I just didn't like.
Right.
See, for me,
well, here's the thing. The cornerstone of what you're talking about is I'm not entertained. The him fighting the dogs doesn't please you, you know, to experience. And that both of you have kind of feeling that about huge, great swathes of the movie. Whereas I can't justify this. I mean, I can talk about all the specifics, but in the end, if this movie is on and it's, let's say, past the half hour point, if this movie is on TV, I can't turn it off. It's one that I cannot leave alone, because I just think there's too, I think it's really rather nicely designed and interestingly shot. I love the editing, of course, but everybody loves the editing. Even the people who hate the editing think it's clever.
Well, we'll get to it.
Okay.
James, let's get to it now, because I'll be honest, when I was watching this, I was going, I love this, but this is, I remember when you first watched the trailer for Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, and you just bristled at the way it looked like they were doing comics effects on the big screen, and you were like, ah, I like, it just looks a bit naff. It looks like they're trying too hard to be comic-y.
Yeah.
And I did wonder what you would make of all of these kind of, I mean, because there's so much stuff going on. Like, there's the multiple frames, you know, there is the, like, one frame kind of receding back to be in the next one. There is kind of stuff popping up in the center of the screen and then becoming the whole frame. You've got these kind of weird, almost presented like split diopter shots where you've got two characters on either side of the screen looking in each other's direction, but it is, the way it's framed, it's clearly two people at different sides of the room. I don't know all the terms for all the stuff that he's doing, but I mean, basically every kind of clever transition he could have come up with, he executes.
He finds
at some
a way
point
to put
during
it in
the movie.
My question is, what is that adding to the movie? Is it just going, hey, this is based on a comic, so let's do a clever comic-y-esque frame? Like, what's it doing to the story? Because it seems to me that he's tried his hardest to make this film as textually, like, apart from the Hulk comics as he possibly can. And try to make it its own standalone science fiction thing where they spend a lot of time talking about DNA as if that explains how you could turn into a Hulk. And then goes, oh, also it's based on a comic though, so let's put some frames in it and stuff.
I don't think he actually cares about any of that stuff though. The DNA and stuff. I think it's literally just a means to an end of telling
the story.
Oh, he's
way
story.
More interested in the personal trauma than
yeah,
science trauma.
It's just the science nonsense is the mechanics to get to where he needs to get to. Like, he needs the memory to be repressed. He needs the Hulk not to turn up until this point.
Yeah, but then like you say, the whole intro is like based around starfish can regenerate. Like this crocodile has armored skin or whatever, and you're just like, who cares? What is any of this? Like, he gets irradiated by gamma radiation and turns into the Hulk. It doesn't matter.
Well, I think because if you're dealing with an audience that know about radiation poisoning, it is reasonable to take the 1990s, 2000s version of what science is and what people will buy in science fiction.
Can I give you my kind of read on the overall movie that I think is bedded in that first 10 minutes?
Go for it.
Go on.
So I think that this movie has an awful lot in common with and is a lot more successful at telling the Sins of the Fathers story than Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 is.
Oh, well, hey.
To the point where the parallel becomes the hero fights his dad, who is manifested as a cloud.
Yeah.
In the final act.
Yeah.
And like the dad has created the son.
Yeah.
But ultimately, after being reunited after many, many years, all he wants him for is to harvest his powers.
Yes.
Good
Lord, Joe.
There's clear parallels there, but I think for me, the Sins of the Father storyline, I think it's Ang Lee going, the thought process of being, and Ang Lee and James Seamus, I think, who are probably equal authors of this adaptation, going, right, what makes the Hulk the Hulk? Well, it is this manifestation of this thing inside him. The Hulk is often childlike and still has been in, you know, in the MCU adaptations. So it's almost like this repressed, angry toddler that has been frozen in time, this unresolved trauma from his childhood that is going to burst out and have a tantrum.
Well, that is canonical, to be fair. Like,
yes, but that's what I think the starting point is.
Yeah.
And then I think he's gone, right, so if it's this repressed trauma from childhood, what is that? Okay, it's his dad. And for a kind of a story where a hero, sorry, or where a character kind of, because Ang Lee also talks about approaching this as almost like kind of like one of the old Universal monster movies, that it's kind of a Frankenstein story early on. And, you know, because the Hulk isn't, he isn't straightforward superhero, is he?
No.
You know, no, back in the car, and I know he's kind of taken on a superhero role at various times, and now that is the view of the Hulk that we have. But obviously, I know early on, James, he was the villain, right? And I think there's been a series recently that's really lent into the horror. Is it at the Al Ewing's version of the Hulk?
Yeah, the Immortal Hulk. That, I mean, that's a sort of radically different take on the Hulk,
even like Planet Hulk, because that kind of ends with him just going, fuck it, I'm the
villain. Yeah, I mean, he is at various points the villain. Like, yeah. People often talk about the Hulk as a Frankenstein story, but for me, the core of Hulk is that it's a sort of King Kong Godzilla story.
Yes, and I think there are...
This leans into some of the King Kongness for sure.
Yeah,
yeah, definitely.
Him putting Betty in the car is right before the dogfight is such a King Kongy move.
Yeah, I finish that thought on the overall read of the movie is that for this character, be he hero, villain, whatever, monster, for this guy to have been, this Hulk to have been created through nuclear power, and you know, in a film that is so heavy on the military, I think there's something about the Americans setting off that nuclear bomb and the decades and decades of fallout from that, and for the future generations that you know nuclear warfare sees. I think Ang Lee tracks that back and goes, right, the father has to be the one that sets this in motion, and it's the next generation who sees through the trauma of that and becomes the manifestation of it, and the ultimate fight has to be the kid grappling with that dad, who, well, I don't know if it's fair to say never really cared about him, but never cared about him more than he cared about.
Not yet. No, there's very little. There's very little empathy going on with that Nick Nolte character. He's really haunting. I think he's bloody marvelous in this. He's incredibly unsettling to be around. Like, you do not want, when she goes to his house, I don't want her in there.
Mm. And he says something about her being very beautiful, and you kind of have that moment where you're like, is this creepy because it feels predatory? And it isn't. It's creepy because he's saying that, and you're like, but that's, he's only saying that to throw her off. He's got no interest in her sexually. That's not,
nope.
there's no sexual threat here.
No, she's not, she's only interesting in academic ways to him. Mm. Like how she can function with his son is the whole of his interest. It's difficult to make a Hulk movie just at its core, because the Hulk story is too much like a werewolf story. It's the thing inside you that at certain times is going to break free and do damage. And that works if you're making a horror movie. If you're making a superhero movie, and the emphasis is very much on the available heroism of that character, it's quite hard to build it, because the hero spends the entire movie going, don't change, don't change, don't get involved, step away. And it's bloody hard to write a movie where the hero literally doesn't want the premise of the movie to happen, ever. Right? And that works in a horror movie because it's frightening then that it does happen. But what's really hard is to make this half a horror movie and half a superhero movie. And it's why Hulk standalone films are really tough to do. It's also why when Marvel get hold of this properly and do their own version, they A, find it equally as difficult, and B, end up copying the structure of this movie. Because even if you start from a point of view of, let's not do that again, what you end up doing is, okay, so he'll accidentally transform in the first act and it'll be dark and shrouded in shadow. And then he'll do a couple of big ones in the middle and that'll be all fighting the military. And then he'll do one at the end where he fights something big in CGI. Mm.
Yeah.
The shape of those two movies trace right over each other, because that's almost the only way to do a Hulk movie, solo movie, adequately. It's also never completely satisfying. because your hero's chasing the idea of preventing the movie from happening.
Yeah, that is something inherent, isn't it? Sometimes you can make really compelling stories out of that, of a central character who is actively trying to be the impediment to the thing you're watching.
Absolutely.
But it's tough, and
it's really hard to do.
Seamus talks about, like, for him the most interesting part of the Hulk being not being his transformation, but him kind of dealing with it afterwards, and the transition from the Hulk back into Banner being the most dramatically interesting thing, but not something that works in an action movie. I think the MCU has had, for all that, I know a lot of people don't like it, I think Age of Ultron gloms onto that the interest.
Well, and thing. I happen to like that as well, which is yes. maybe part and parcel of the same thing.
James, where does this land for you in terms of cinematic Hulks? Do you prefer the Norton story? Or the movie, the character, any of it?
It's really hard for me to place it. Like, I think just on a pure entertainment level, I just find this movie so consistently dull. At least The Incredible Hulk, like, the locations are interesting, the actors, if they're not better, they're at least more familiar to me. I don't rate either of them particularly highly. I think I would call Hulk maybe a 1.5-star movie, and Incredible Hulk a 2-star movie.
Whoa!
Like, I think they are both incredibly flawed and just doing the wrong things with the character.
Let's talk performances, and for these, I want to kind of talk about these on the Hulk adaptation gamut. So we've got Betty. There's two Bettys for us to compare between.
This movie wins the Bettys. Come on.
Do you agree with that, Jake? Because I'm so pro Jennifer Connelly. I think she's.
It wins, but again, she's not doing anything interesting.
She's absolutely she's given the story of going after the dad. When the military aren't doing that,
I don't find her a compelling character, though. Like, she's just sort of there. And
but you see, I kind of like that it gives her the grounded version of Hulk's story, of Banner's story. So you've got Bruce, who and both of their traumas are depicted through dream sequences, and so. And
hers, by the way, her dream sequence is one that he remembers from a photograph. There's a hell of a I can hold my hands up to the flaws of the movie. The way we get to that sequence is that he looks at a photograph of them, and then he remembers her telling him about the dream.
Yes.
which is structurally maybe a bit off.
And it feels motivated perhaps by the fact that Ang Lee had this idea of doing a moving photograph.
Yeah. And actually, the flip side is also true, because the way Hulk gets his memory back of his mother being stabbed is because his dad tells Betty. And we cut back to him in his water tank remembering it.
Yes.
These things, they're the right things to come out, but they're coming out in completely the wrong way.
And again, that feels like very idiosyncratic James Seamus kind of storytelling.
Can we I don't know if he's, because he's not credited solely with the screenplay.
But I think
he was the last writer on the project, but I know that there was a big deal about the arbitration for this one.
My takeaway is that he is the primary author of this. He's Ang Lee's, you know, consigliere across just about everything. And I think that all of the weird stuff in there is Ang Lee and Seamus working together. Seamus apparently worked on a production draft of X-Men very early on in the production process. Met Avi Arad through that, and they stayed in touch, and then eventually they were like, Hulk, and he was like, yeah, sure. and he'd since had the Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon success, and so came in and I believe did the bulk of the work on this edit.
I don't necessarily doubt it, but you've got to watch when three writers have gone through arbitration that there is a requirement that that their stuff is in there.
Like, yeah, it's interesting that Seamus gets story and screenplay credits.
It is. And actually, you read back on what the different drafts were, because they had the leader in here and they had all sorts of characters, and it just got refined down and down. Absorbing Man and the Dad were two different characters and eventually got merged. There's a huge and convoluted history. Michael France goes in and out of the production over and over and over again. And actually, even the list of producers is really interesting, because you've got Avi Arad and Kevin Feige and Gail Ann Hurd.
Like, wow. Yeah.
Any one of these would give you very different expectations for the kind of movie you were going to get. So the idea that in some way they've collaborated feels bonkers. So no wonder the movie's confused, is what I'm saying.
And Seamus producing himself as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a bizarre concoction. Sorry, you were doing performances, Joe, and I've
to go back to Betty and those two dream sequences, right? So I think basically, like, and this is me taking this from the commentary, but Lee says basically Bruce Banner's dream is Hulk's reality, and that kind of that inner aggression and survival instinct and that repressed trauma that basically is Hulk. So Bruce Banner's memories of something bad happening when he was a kid, but not quite knowing what.
Yeah.
That is the Hulk, this angry but confused
thing.
That's
a lovely quote as well. I think that's why I like him, and I think that's why I like the movie, is that I keep feeling that level of think through, like the philosophy behind things.
And you see, I think, when you were like, if this movie is ever on, I would want to watch it. Yeah. I am more in the camp of, if anyone's ever recording a podcast or if Ang Lee's ever talking about this or whatever, I want to hear about it.
Interesting.
I think I'm far more interested in like, honestly, I would watch Ang Lee's commentary again before I watch the movie again. I think I kind of come out on the movie 3 stars, I'm just so much more invested in it when I'm thinking about it than I am when I'm watching it. I guess I could do both of those at the same time.
I can't track any of this movie onto the stuff I love about the Hulk, which is probably a big part of the problem for me.
Yes.
Like, because I love the character in the comics, and like I say, the thing I like most about this movie is that they treat him with some level of respect. Like, it's not the TV show where they go, like, oh, you know, it's just a sort of wandering hobo take where, you know, he's like the fucking A-team or whatever. Like, I really like that they went back to the character and said, okay, what's been done with the Hulk aside from the thing everyone knows about in pop culture?
Yeah.
And so he, you know, picked up that and ran with it. Like, you know, all respect to him for doing that. It's just that when I come and see a Hulk movie, I'm just like, this doesn't have any of the things I want to see in it.
Can I sell you on the possibility that the stuff in the big battling the military stuff in the desert, and indeed his running away from so much of it, is getting closer to what you would have liked? And in particular, I'm thinking of things like jumping on a jet to stop it crashing, because there's a Hulk instinct for that person doesn't need to needlessly die.
Yeah, like the Hulk instinct should be like, protects the person who can't protect themselves. Like the thing that Hulk movies generally, I think, miss is that the character has this enormous empathy for everyone around him. And like when they attack him, he doesn't understand why he's being attacked. Like, he doesn't want to lash out. He wants to get away. And like, they back him into a corner, and he saves the people who are hurt, and
jumps, James.
Yeah, he jumps.
And by the way, the wind on his face stuff, Like, the delight in being free and in the open and not being attacked for a bit is one of my favourite things. There's a real zen quality to the bouncing Hulk that I really like. Look at me with the wind on my face and without anything to bother me for miles.
I remember the jumping being the thing that was the, like, stick that was used to poke this movie for so long.
Oh.
That it was a bit shit. And I was watching it and going, I like the jumping.
No, yeah, I liked it, because when it happened, I was like, oh, that's a thing he does in the comics. Like, if he wants to get away, he would just do a massive jump.
Can I also, one of my favourite little bits, and it's so in line with what you're talking about, James, and I'm suddenly realising, I could stand to see a little more of this version of get away, why would you even hurt me? Mm-hmm. Like, not treating the Hulk like a wrath beast, because he's anger, he's not wrath.
Yeah.
And the distinction there is one that gets missed very easily. And one of my favourite little moments is quite early on, where he's transformed for the first time and he sees his dad through the crack in the door, and his dad sees him back, this thing his son has become. And Hulk doesn't go forwards. He jumps through the ceiling and goes away. And I thought that was, like, spot-on understanding of, like, oh, yeah, because his thing isn't, I want to kill anyone within the vicinity or destroy everything in the vicinity. It's, this thing is upsetting and I need to get away from it. Mm-hmm.
And I think that potentially Ang Lee's intent for this movie, James, is closer to what you wanted than perhaps what you have ended up getting from it. Because,
yeah.
So Lee is definitely, he is a comic fan. I don't know if you've seen the Ice Storm, but the Ice Storm is kind has this Fantastic Four framing device, mm-hmm. Which is, you know, telling a story about a couple of very fractured families, and does that through the prism of Spider-Man himself, Tobey Maguire, and comic books. And one of the other things that he said that was really interesting to me, and I think does track through those action sequences with the Hulk, is that he was like, for him, the Hulk is like, anger is the catalyst that turns him into the Hulk, but the overriding emotion that kind of powers him is anxiety. That Bruce Banner has this inner anxiety because of that trauma that he's gone through. And so when he does, the anger is the thing that pushes him into becoming the Hulk, but actually the Hulk is more, he's an anxiety monster. He's not an anger monster, and I think that probably tracks with what you were saying you like, but obviously you didn't actually end up getting enough of it.
Yeah, well, that's because, like, the thing I ultimately want to see out of a Hulk movie is, like, the character having some level of redemption and being, like, able to say, you know, at the end of it, actually, maybe the Hulk isn't so bad. You know, he did destroy our houses, but he saved us from this thing. And actually what this movie gets is, well, he managed to beat up his dad, so obviously, you know.
He managed to... That dad is becoming more and more and more powerful and dangerous.
But he's not threatening anyone other than the Hulk, and maybe nebulously the rest of the world.
Well, I totally agree with that. The third act definitely doesn't go, wait, what happens once he gets what he wants from the Hulk? Because that is... His whole aim is to reactivate the Hulk, get what he wants from him, and move on. But of course, he's definitely a sociopath.
Yeah.
And once he's a big, huge, lightning-generated, you know, electric killing machine, there isn't any emphasis put on what the stakes are next. But I do think Hulk's big thing is get him away from a populated area and deal with this problem.
Yeah, but it's disconnected from any humanity. It's just like, get him away from the city, fight him in the desert, and... Okay.
It's all about father and son. He literally hands his father his trauma to destroy him. Like, that's the big final action.
It's very clever.
Have it. Have all of it.
It's very clever.
Have it all.
Do you know why
it's very clever.
Do you know why I think it doesn't work? I think it doesn't work because, well, let's get back to the performance review. I don't think Eric Banner's very good, and I think it is. And I think when I was talking at the start about the effects not quite working, the look of the Hulk not quite working for me, I have exactly the same problem with the Norton Hulk. I can't see
You can't see Eric Banner in it.
I can't see Eric Banner in him, but I also, which also means I can't see the performance tracking between the two. And yes. I loved that Ang Lee was passionate enough about this that he wanted to see the motion capture. But I kind of wish it was Eric Banner because,
you kind of want
Banner's performance to have at least a kind of a twinkle of that inner anger.
The fact that you can definitely see Ruffalo through the CG makes a huge difference to those Hulk appearances.
Yeah. And I think, and I do think it affects his performance as Bruce Banner. I think having to deliver a performance that operates in both of those spaces, I think it benefits him when he's in the his Bruce Banner mode as well.
Yeah, no, I don't think that's wrong. I don't think that's at all unreasonable. I quite like Banner's. I quite like Eric Banner's Bruce Banner. In as much as I quite enjoy, how repressed he's willing to be, and I feel like there's a similarity between that and what Ruffalo ends up doing, which is this kind of like, I have to be so low key in my day to day life. Mm. Only he's low key pre Hulk, whereas with Ruffalo's version of the character, it's because I'm the Hulk, I have to be very low key.
Yeah.
Whereas here, it's like, I have to be low key because of my massively repressed trauma that I've actually forgotten about. And then also, I'm a Hulk on top.
See,
I think that's why everyone thinks that Ruffalo, aside from the visual comparison, why Ruffalo would make a great Columbo.
Yeah.
because it is that guy. He kind of in his Bruce Banner mode has that slightly kind of hunched over, like, oh, don't worry about me. I'm nothing. I'm not
desperately unassuming. Yeah.
Just put that man in a trench coat.
So all right, so the battle of the banners. I mean, come on, Norton isn't any great
chance. I mean, so
but,
this is.
I think he's better.
I want to make a point better. Here, which is that when Ed Norton was announced for Bruce Banner, I was so excited because his performance in Fight Club is virtually perfect for Bruce Banner, and then he turns up in Incredible Hulk, and he is so bored.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think he's so bored in all the scenes he didn't write, and they edited that hour out of the movie. And so he probably... you look at the deleted scenes... Actually, no, he doesn't even bring it in the deleted scenes.
No.
It's a very sleepwalky, nothing-y...
Definitely, Ed Norton in Fight Club is the best Bruce Banner.
That's more reasonable. I mean, actually, that and Primal Fear, like he had an early run at being... but presenting as one person while having something a lot more dangerous going on.
And then American History X is like the flip of that, right? That he's actively trying to repress it in the
yes, can
half
you
of the
prove
movie.
That there's actually a Bruce Banner still inside this Hulk guy? Is the
And 25th hour late 90s, early 2000s, Ed Norton, you're like, how many Oscars does this guy end up winning?
Hey, I really liked Motherless Brooklyn just while we're on Ed Norton. So that's a good movie.
It's just fascinating where his career kind of, maybe it was around Hulk, but it just kind of stopped, didn't it?
Yeah, it's funny,
well, that's
isn't it?
Hulk was him becoming quote unquote difficult, right? That's when he became difficult Ed Norton, and that's what gets people to not be on movies anymore.
Yeah, and to be fair, like, I like the Italian Job remake quite a lot as a great big fun silly heist movie, but he sleepwalks through that as well, and he's the villain. Like, he's got every reason to be. Massively entertaining in that movie.
So James, I wanted to ask James this question. Ang Lee says in the comics no one cares about Bruce Banner and that he wanted to try and make audiences care. I think he fails, but I'm more interested in the, is that true? Because I would actually say anytime I've read a comic with Bruce Banner in, I've gone, yeah, I don't care. Give me the Hulk. I wondered whether is that why Planet Hulk is so successful?
I mean, part of the thing, right, is that most of the Hulk comics I've read don't deal exclusively in Banner versus the Hulk. They're all about the relationship between the two and the symbiosis between the two.
Mm.
Like, Planet Hulk is a sort of exception in that it just says Bruce Banner is like on an alien planet and he goes, fuck this, I'm being the Hulk full time. You drive.
Yeah.
Like, that's fine. Most of the comics I've read, and probably most Hulk comics for probably the last 30 years, have basically been like, either he's some combination of Bruce Banner and the Hulk, or the Hulk is in charge, or, you know, Bruce Banner's actively rid himself of the Hulk and only exist in that context. Like, it's
a relationship story, right?
Yeah.
It's
like, you, I don't think you could have anyone care about Bruce Banner without the Hulk.
Yeah.
That's certainly true. I don't think it's true of this movie either, though. I think Bruce Banner is on screen and you're going, why do I care about you? You're boring and not very nice.
Oh, you're gonna break my heart.
I think that's interesting. I think that's probably, for me, one of the biggest failings of Infinity War Endgame, is that the Hulk-Banner relationship was resolved off-screen.
Yeah, definitely.
And you kind of feel like... Well, and I think there was a version of it that we never actually saw, but the third act felt like it was... I don't believe that was supposed to be Mark Ruffalo inside the Hulkbuster armor. I think it was supposed to be Hulk inside it, and something went wrong, and we just never get to see that relationship resolved. It's so frustrating.
That felt like a last minute change of some kind, didn't it?
Yeah.
Not that's what this is about, but yeah.
And he kind of gets his little hero moment, doesn't he? Where he kills one of the.
One of the Outriders, yeah.
Yes. As much as I liked what we got from Hulk in Endgame, I wish I could have seen that happen, those two entities resolve.
It's difficult because they've made a clear point of going, actually, I don't think Hulk or Banner are protagonists particularly in this story. Right, all the way through from the very first Avengers, like, there's absolutely an interest in the character, like putting together with Black Widow and stuff is stuff I still really enjoy, and I know that's controversial, but that is stuff I really enjoy.
Me too. And
in the end, though, it's he's the thing that causes the problem on the helicarrier, and then he's the MacGuffin you bring in to do more violence at the end in that first Avengers movie. And we'd explore the character more, but there's never a point where it's honestly kind of the narrative is honestly handed to Bruce Banner to take forward. I don't think the closest you get is being next to Tony when Tony makes Ultron. You know,
I mean,
so it's quite hard to...
They do make a point, don't they, in Avengers, of they bring him in because they need a super scientist, not because they need a Hulk.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. Go on, we were going through the cast. This is taking forever.
Yeah, but we're getting so many interesting
It is.
Segments.
No, the digressions are better than the topic, but come on, keep doing them.
I think now as we shift over to Thunderbolt Ross... I think this also gives me the opportunity to finally resolve my argument about Betty and about what her dream that we get. So in her dream, she is abandoned by her dad, who runs off, obviously, to investigate the gamma explosion that that David Banner, the Nick Nolte character, mm-hmm. has set off back in the 60s. So she's left alone. She is abandoned by her father. She turns and sees Bruce. But then Bruce, kind of in a POV shot, appears that he's reaching forward to put his hands around her neck to strangle her.
Which he does later in the movie.
Yes.
Well. Yeah.
And aside from the obvious foreshadowing, I think there's her own daddy issues there where she kind of feels abandoned by her father, and that she has found this new kind of male presence in her life as an adult, which is Bruce, but she has recognized that there is something dangerous or unhealthy there, and as much as she wants to embrace that, she can't quite. And her narrative kind of being the flip of Bruce's, where so Bruce's daddy issues are so much more irreparable, and he ends up fighting and kind of throwing his trauma back at his dad, whereas she gets the opportunity to resolve her issues kind of with both of them over the course of the movie. So with her dad, who ultimately trusts her to play the part she needs to play with Bruce, And then with Bruce himself, she finds the strength to kind of face him down as the Hulk. I liked that she was A, a counterpoint to him, and that B, she had something that she was doing throughout the movie, which was, you know, actually challenging Nick Nolte. So she serves the function that Nick Nolte doesn't need to come face to face with Bruce Banner too often during the movie. You get that kind of scene early on and then at the end, don't you?
I mean, look at how you've talked about that, and it's a world away from, like, Rachel McAdams in Doctor Strange.
Yeah.
Right? There is at least, and I get not digging it, but there is an absolute intent to keep her front and centre of a series of narratives. Now, they are narratives that are all about the male lead, but that's unfortunately how movies work. Everybody is about the lead. The solution to that is more films about women. But she does go actively in pursuit of the dad, in pursuit of the problem, in pursuit of solutions to her own trauma, and in solutions to his trauma. One of the big things on the military base is she persuades Ross to let her take Bruce out and try and explore what's wrong with him psychologically, rather than them just putting him in a tank and putting a drill in his neck. I think it's a really textured, interesting set of stuff for her to do, and I think as a performance she acquits herself excellently.
See, I don't disagree with any of that, but when I'm watching it, I'm just sitting there going, like, why do you care about any of this? Like, who are you? I think it's built so much around the themes. And
look,
I do get it.
The connectedness, that there's just nothing I relate to there.
There is definitely a problem with how aspects of this thing are even put together. Because if you sign up for a Hulk movie, the one thing you can be comfortably sure of is that when the moment happens that's going to turn him into the Hulk, it's going to be a big, exciting moment. And this movie instead pulls the camera back, turns the sound down, and fades to black. Like, he does the thing of saving the guy, and that actually is quite nimbly directed, although the guy's just kind of cowering, but it works, like, as a credible piece of human fear. But then Bruce steps in front of it, and instead of being, like, blasted by gamma radiation, the understanding is, oh no, this radiation's invisible, so we're going to have to do it as a post effect that you know is a post effect. Like, we're going to flood the screen with green, but you'll understand nothing was green in the room. The movie is saying, oh, like green things. And it feels like there's a series of things like that. There are scenes where they end and you go, did anything just change?
Mm.
And, oh, I'll tell you what, one of my favourite little scenes where nothing really happens is very early on. Betty goes and has the dinner with her father, and she hasn't seen him in years, and he warns her off Bruce. And what's really interesting about that scene, apart from it's really interested in her as a character, like, it cuts to her and lets her pick up the story. We're quite early on, and it already segues off from Bruce to say, no, the Betty story's also a thing. She goes to see his father, and all through that scene, they are crossing the 180 degree line. And I swear to God, I know you talked about, like, what does the editing do for the story? And it's not that it does much doesn't add to the story, but what it does add is tone. And whether you like that tone or not is, you know, totally an individual thing. But what I think Ang Lee looked at the comics and went, this allows you to cross the line. I don't get to do that in films. And he finds a way to do it. And I'll tell you what, if you just look at that dinner scene, it's one of the best edited scenes ever, because it manages to jump the camera both sides of the dining table without ever getting you lost or feeling like somebody cheated or that the cut was wrong, because he always matches it to a piece of action, a bit of business. The camera is recentering the line over and over and over again to talk about how odd and unsettling and multi-angled this conversation is.
I noticed it in the first interrogation scene between Thunderbolt Ross and Tulk. And Bruce Banner, and the camera there is kind of it's kind of arcing behind each of them, so it's kind of doing the over the shoulder shot over one of them. But it keeps getting closer in, and then when it does pull back, it's almost at this really steep angle that's looking down at them.
Oh yeah.
And it's this kind of like, it feels like originally that it's getting more intimate and more intimate, and then suddenly, like when Sam Elliott goes, "Oh, you don't remember, right? Okay," and then the camera mm-hmm. pulls back and watches it like a remove. And I think it is. I think for me, the editing at a lot of times adds. It kind of has that. It adds the pace to the movie. The transitions for me do feel like page turns, like and skipping between panels and having that real propulsive storytelling that, which I would have never realized or thought that would have been possible before I read comics through this podcast. But like action sequences in comics being as kinetic as they are for still images, yes. And I think you add something to the movie by doing that.
I really think you do.
But then also, like, I think it allows for. It makes, as you were saying, with crossing the line, but it makes for some really unnatural framing and some really unnatural close-ups feel natural and feel at place in the movie. So you can kind of there's a shot where we'll talk about him in a minute, but Eric Banner walks into the room. And Josh Lucas is in there talking to Jennifer Connelly.
Oh, yes.
And the kind of little frames that come up just kind of watch each of their eyes as they're looking at each other.
Yeah, who's looking at who. And
Ang Lee was... I think Ang Lee was talking about how, like, it's the sound design that kind of guides your eyes visually through those scenes where there are multiple things where... The sound design will flip from panel to panel, as you kind of don't realise when you're watching it, but it's the sound that's telling you where to look next.
That's really interesting.
And it does, for me, it does, like, it's a movie that's 2 hours, 10 minutes long, I think, and it doesn't feel that long.
Yeah.
Which is surprising to me, because, as I say, I do sympathise with some of James's arguments of, like, at times this movie doesn't...
Well, because sometimes it gets downright alienating. Like, I do understand that. And one of my favourite things is the willingness it has to be fascinated by landscape. Like, there's a real interest in, here's a close-up of desert flowers, here's a very close-up shot of a rock.
Ang Lee was getting so excited about when Betty and Bruce go back to his childhood home. And he was like, and we didn't use any lighting at all. No reflectors, no nothing. It's just, that's that kind of stark, bright light out in the desert. And that lights the whole thing. And he has this one shot of it that is really impactful. And I think the desert shots are really impactful. And that's what I was talking about for me.
Yeah.
The exterior stuff is fantastic.
I think it's beautiful. I really think the big, wide stuff. That's the one thing that I really felt. Because obviously this came out. Not that long before the second attempt by Marvel to do it.
It's 5 years, right? It's not much, right? It's not much at all.
So you can't help but sit and compare the two. And one of the things...
That amount of time for two versions of Justice League to come out.
There's something... The bigness of this, like, this is very, very committed. And they're equivalent budgets. Like, one wasn't massively more expensive than the other. But this one puts all of the bigness into the camera, and you see scale of landscape, scale of emotion, scale of all this thing. When you get to the Hulk fighting an Incredible Hulk, he has like this scrap on a college campus in quite a contained piece of lawn, and that's like the big that's the first big fight. Our guy here is doing okay. That was the Hulk dogs the first time, like that's the equivalent of the Hulk dogs, that scene. But his big, huge rampages feel so much smaller to me in Incredible Hulk than they feel in this one, where make it a parking lot. And they, you're like, well, wait, is that not a national monument?
In Incredible Hulk's defense, and I don't think it works, but I think they go, what if we put him in more contained areas? Won't the destruction of that be more interesting? So they intentionally go, let's put him in a factory, and then let's put him on the Berkeley campus, and then let's put him in Harlem.
I mean, that's fair to a point, but then nothing on the Berkeley campus gets destroyed.
No. No, he breaks a window, I think.
Yeah, like he's literally inside that like bridge thing when he changes, and it holds up fine.
Yeah, that I mean, that sequence is bad. Like,
no,
I say,
actually, there's a piece of
not...
art, right? It's the bit of metal art that gets destroyed. He uses it as a shield briefly, and...
Yeah, I'm not defending that in terms of execution. I think it was more intentional.
On the script level, yeah, that's probably what they were going for.
But I think when you look at it executed, it looks like they ran out of money to do Hulk at the right scale in that movie. And we're like, well, we'll have to save it for the finale, really. We can't afford to do it. It's going to be quite brief scuffles in the middle because there's no way to do this. Ang Lee, whatever he got out of the budget, and obviously there's 5 years of inflation, but still, what he gets out of the budget there is enormous. It looks huge.
My frustration when we get to those big kind of... like, and I love the shot of him, like, the camera panning out so far. He looks tiny, kind of hopping around the desert and on that rocky area and stuff. And that I like that, but the problem is, and I'm sure this is driven by the effects, anytime the Hulk comes out, all of that interesting editing kind of has to just be thrown away to go, and now we do Hulk stuff.
Hang on. Hulk bursting out of the facade on the base, on the flats, where they
that is good.
Is one of the best edits in the history of movies. And I also, I'll tell you what else I love, is that thing where they use three location stills and he hops between them.
Yeah, well, those locations are awfully close together.
No, it's one panorama, but they take the photograph separately and make them deliberately look like they don't blend together, so they look like separate photograph panels, and then he moves across them.
But, you know, like, when he's fighting the dogs, when he's fighting his dad at the end, it kind of... it ends up feeling more conventional to me than most of the movie has allowed for.
Although, to be fair, the things going on screen are so insane at both of those points that it's like, maybe you don't need any more? Because, like, his dad becomes a projector for all the comic book panels that are going on in his head in that finale.
Yeah, can we talk about that final fight, actually? Because I think I would have forgiven a lot more about the movie if the conclusion had been comprehensible.
Yeah. James, can I ask a question? Did you watch this HD or standard def?
I only have the DVD, so...
See, on DVD, I think that finale is damn near impenetrable. But I bought the Blu-ray cheap, not quite because this podcast was coming up, but only a few months ago. And when this podcast was off, I was like, I just bought this. It's like destiny. Because I'd been living with it on DVD for years and kind of hating that finale. And I watched it in HD, and it's so much clearer what's going on shot by shot.
That is interesting.
I'm not saying it redeems the literal events, but it does. It does make you not resent the thing that's maybe or maybe not happening in front of your eyes.
Yeah.
And let me just drop the incredible bombshell that Hulk has just been released in 4K. There is a 4K steelbook available at Zavvi. If it should that.
Oh, Joe, what are you doing to me?
It comes with 4 exclusive art cards.
Just in time.
4, you say?
Put those on your wall. Show your devotion to that particular iteration of the Hulk.
They've also done the same thing for the Incredible Hulk. And also for the Universal Hulk Collection, which I think might just be the two of them together.
That's funny. Well, you know what, though? It's so close to this movie working in canon with the other movie. Because the title sequence, right, for the Incredible Hulk almost feels like bits of this movie mm-hmm. cut together.
Yeah.
I think the Incredible Hulk was intentionally doing that, where it was going, look, audiences have seen a Hulk story recently. And even if they haven't, they kind of get it. Let's just get it out of the way and pick it up. But to the point that, right, he's in South America.
Like, yeah, yeah.
It feels like it could be a direct continuation. He goes back to Berkeley. It doesn't feel like there's anything that's a direct contradiction.
The only thing that is sort of suspicious is that in the Incredible Hulk intro, it shows him sitting in the chair to irradiate himself like he did from the 70s TV show.
Right, yes.
But that could be anything happening, right?
Yeah, you can headcanon that away quite easily.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask about that. One thing that felt like just a slight missing link in this was so his dad has turned back up, he's still got the repressed memories, he's obviously still got whatever has the potential to become the Hulk lurking inside of him. And then the gamma experiment goes wrong and sets it in motion.
The gamma and the nanomeds.
And the yes.
He takes those in simultaneously with the gamma blast and the fact that he's got his dad's bizarre tested DNA.
So it's all so convoluted in there that I kind of...
Yeah.
I wanted Nolte to be pulling those strings. You know, I wanted him to have cocked with the machine to make it
Yeah,
to make
it's
it
bizarre,
go.
Isn't it, that... That he didn't sabotage that machine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I was watching it going like, oh, that's clearly what happened, but it hadn't.
Well, when I watched it back, I was like, did I miss something?
Right. And yeah.
But evidently not.
Actually, I'll tell you what, again, talking about just like how this thing zigs when it badly needs to zag, his first transformation happens because he's laid in his hospital bed feeling bad about the conversation he had a little while ago. And I get it, because like your long lost father and all your repressed trauma, something's coming up. But in terms of like just executing this in a way that feels movie like and visceral, it's quite odd to have a character go through their biggest change when nothing specific has just happened.
But it feels deliberately obtuse in those moments.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think that's the thing, is you have to, in the same way as I like close-ups of rocks and of wind and of desert flowers, because it wants to talk about states of mind and zen-like states of mind, and it wants to do some of the cool stuff is in the hallucinations, not hallucinations, but the sort of representations of Banner's mental state, which is where you get puny humoured from Hulk on the other side of the glass. Like, it doesn't do any of these scenes literally. It does them all sort of in that sort of much more obscure mode. And I totally get why people don't respond to that.
And I will agree with James that the amount of business that we have to get through for Hulk to become the Hulk from a science techie level is just, it's so much.
Yeah.
And it does feel at some point you're like, just tidy this up for me slightly.
It is the literal opposite of organic web shooters, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, okay, look, we don't need 5 pieces of mad science to make this happen. We just say, spider, therefore he also makes webs.
But I'm sure if you talk to Ang Lee, he would say, right, okay, so the DNA stuff at the start is important because A, it has to be his dad, and then B, animals, he talks about like wanting to start specifically this bit, wanting to get like his dad being interested in animals and their kind of evolution and getting back to the idea of cells having kind of emotions or memory of their own. Mm-hmm. So that's where he starts off, and then he didn't dig into the rest, but I'm sure he would have similar reasons for, and this is why it needs to be nanomeds, and then
I would put money actually that nanomeds is the thing that he couldn't take out, that it's the sort of thing that you lose an argument with a producer about and go, fine, because it's just a plastic bag for 2 shots, what difference does it make?
I don't know, because
that means science, right? Science,
yeah, it means, and you like, there's never even that thing people do with nanotechnology, which is show you the super close-up of the nano things. It's only empty plastic bag. Container.
There's a bag full of science with a biohazard logo on.
But I think you're right. I think I think you're right that there is a thing about if you have an interest in, an affinity with, a delight in a certain kind of body horror. And I, by the way, I think the Fantastic Four movie is pitifully bad at trying to do the body horror thing it's trying to do. But if you're into it, because maybe my favourite scene in this is Nick Nolte turning into the Absorbing Man.
Oh, it's great. I think that might be the best effect scene in the movie.
It's one of the most haunting images when his hand goes through the metal because it's part of the metal now. The blue metal thing. It's the most haunting, unsettling, because my first thought is, Jesus, what if you can never get your hand out?
And it has this kind of scrapey sound when
it's
his
beautifully
fingers.
The audio on it is amazing.
Hmm. I think on a technical level, this movie is fantastic.
There's a lot of great stuff going on.
The editing's great. The sound design's great. Yeah.
I don't disagree with any of that. What I do question is whether it succeeds as a piece of storytelling.
I think the storytelling's quite clean and efficient. It's whether you're engaged in it or not, and if it doesn't get you, if it doesn't hold you, and that first 40 minutes is very like the comparison to Batman Begins is not unreasonable for the straightforward reason that Batman isn't in Batman Begins for half of Batman Begins.
God, don't get me started.
I know, and the thing is, I love Batman Begins, so we can't, you know, but. So it's whether you think like the warm up to the psychology of what we're going to be dealing with is worth it. But I would still say if you take from his capture to and placement in the desert to the point where he's collected again in San Francisco, and there's that amazing single shot or two shots actually of him transforming all the way back down and all the water coming off him on the San Francisco street as he drops to his knees. And he's both times when we watch him de-transform that way, he's like a newborn foal. Like his knees become weak and his body's always wet. But if you take that one section, I think that's a very good Hulk movie. It's whether or not the bonkers stuff at the far end and the wannabe drama stuff at the front end make that middle work for you.
I agree. And I think it doesn't.
Yeah. But if I handed you that middle, would there be a possibility that you went, oh, I'd quite like to see the front end of this because the middle of this is looking quite interesting?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's almost working. I'm getting there.
Right, 35 minutes ago, conservatively, I said we were going to say what we thought of Thunderbolt Ross as,
oh, yes,
as a performance.
I love this version.
I love it too.
This is the best version.
Right,
yes.
If we can get J.K. Simmons back after all this time.
Yeah, it is the J. Jonah Jameson of this casting, isn't it?
100%.
He's perfect. And get this right, Sam Elliott didn't want to have a mustache in this movie.
God. Oh my God. Damn it.
Of all the movies.
Yeah, well, yeah, but for perfectly legitimate reasons, he was like, he's a military man. Military men do not wear mustaches.
Oh.
And Ang Lee was like,
Thunderbolt Ross does.
Yeah, yeah, and blokes don't turn green. You're going to have to get on board with it.
And so he says, so basically what they landed out on was obviously Sam Elliott has sported many a mustache over his years. And where they agreed to kind of compromise was that it would be a very straight cut across the top of his lip mustache.
Oh, it's so good.
It's almost, it's like quite severe in how like 180 degrees it is across his upper lip. Mm-hmm. So that's where they agreed. But there is, for me, the thing that William Hurt does not have in the MCU movies. Well, I mean, I think the only one that really matters is the Incredible Hulk. But what he doesn't have there is that kind of that warmth and that kind of knowing that he actually does care about Betty and that like that is as much as anything that is his primary concern. Mm. Or and I like that his arc throughout this movie is kind of having that moment in his past where he abandoned his child and getting to the point in the present day where that where she is the priority as much as anything else.
Also, just the gorgeous psychology of, I watched that father kill, or at least I was there when that father killed his wife, and now I'm watching that father's son with my daughter.
Mm.
Yes. Like, the clean line psychology of that. Like, he is so formidable in this movie. That's the thing. I don't think Hurt ever felt formidable. He felt like a guy doing an impression of what formidable would be like. Whereas Sam Elliott, he's indomitable. He's actually Hulk-like in his... He's like a rock. It's completely impervious. You cannot get through.
See, that's sort of the thing I like about Sam Elliott's performance, is that it's kind of exaggerated and a tiny bit cartoonish, in the same way that J.K. Simmons is in Raimi's Spider-Man films. Like, they just feel of a piece together.
Yeah, I watched... I think a lot of this, for me as well, is that... I don't really like William Hurt as an actor, and I'm not... I've certainly not seen a lot of his movies, but the ones that I have seen, I kind of often come out of going, not sure about you. Whereas Sam Elliott is that guy who, in just about anything... I watched The Contender recently, which was a couple of years before this, and... It's a movie that has aged very interestingly, very interestingly. I would say anyone that's followed kind of American politics and gender in the past 5 years should go back and revisit that movie. It's not that it's great, but it's kind of oddly very prescient and shows how little progress we actually have made in those 20 years. He's in that as kind of this kind of a like Ross status level role. He's fantastic in that, but he always is.
He's in Ghost Rider. He turns up in basically scenes in Ghost Rider as the caretaker.
Oh yes. And
it's comfortably the best part of the entire film. When Sam Elliott delivers some exposition, then does a ghost ride on a horse, and then disappears.
There is something very interesting about the fact that Hurt is comes across less strong and rugged and tough and whatever, but doesn't seem at all warm. And yet Sam Elliott is so much harder and sterner, and yet is definitely warm somehow within that.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be honest, I didn't... One of the things that I struggled with was the first time around, I didn't really get in that opening sequence that was Ross. And I know it says it on his jacket, but I just didn't. I was listening to what he was saying rather than reading what was on his shirt. And it was only like halfway through the movie that I clicked and I was like, so they actually were, okay.
He's very hard to cast a young version of. I actually quite like the casting of the two younger versions of those men, but it's quite hard to do.
Yeah.
Well, that's one of the things that reminded me of Superman, which is that they show you, like, you spend the first, 10, 15 minutes of the movie, like, with actors who aren't in the rest of it.
And
I was like, where are the characters I watch this film for? And they turn up sort of later on.
Here's another one that here's another one of those scenes that isn't actually put together properly. But here is another one of those. When we get finally to the truth that Banner's father stabbed his mother, literally nobody in the audience thinks anything other than that's what happened.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's played out as this reveal, and I get that it's Bruce realising it, although it's not, it's Betty being told it while Bruce realises it independently in a tank. But it's so almost right. It's so frustrating. It's the right time for it to happen, but the reveal of it, I think as an audience you go, do they think they've told us something new? Because I assumed he killed the mother.
So I think that scene is telling us something new, and it gets lost because of that. Now the thing that what it is telling us is that is basically, it's Nick Nolte's interior journey up to that point. So he tested on himself he wanted it, not because he was like sacrificing himself, was because he wanted to have the benefits of this experiment. Through whatever fucked up DNA stuff, it ends up going onto his son. So he then goes, right, okay, I wanted this to happen to me. I didn't want to curse my son. I need to cure him. And so he's frantically searching for a cure. And that's when General Ross says, no, you can't do that anymore. You have to stop. Mm-hmm. Effectively damning his son. And it's at that point... It's at that point that he snaps. And that's what I said about, like, kind of, there is a point at which that character has some love and affection for his son.
Mm.
But it's in the first 3 minutes of the movie. And
it happens way too early.
Yeah. So that's when he goes home and he makes the decision, I would rather kill my son than him stay with this inside him for the rest of his life. And that's the information that scene gets across.
Yes, it's that the mother died trying to save Bruce.
Yeah.
And that's the bit that doesn't quite come up over.
So, his mum tried to sacrifice herself for him, which is something that is hugely important emotionally for Bruce. But that B, that is the moment of kind of snapping into supervillain for the father.
Yes.
And then when he fails, like, he's already at that point completely detached emotionally from his son. So when he resurfaces 30 years later, it doesn't matter that he's his son anymore. All that matters is, oh, hang on, you've still got this thing, and I still want it.
In terms of, like, the quality...
It's lost in the execution.
No, it does. You're absolutely right. It's that my mother died to save me, and that's not the thing. There is a line of dialogue about it when we come back out of all of that as well, but it's so lost in the mix.
But it's a crucial moment for the two characters who are going to ultimately be the final confrontation in this film.
Yeah. And, I mean, in terms of quality of filmmaking, though, when they go behind that door, the screaming that happens behind that door is some of the most unsettling screaming I've ever heard committed to film. Like, it's genuine. Again, we're into a horror movie, but it's a horror movie behind there. And whatever your brain puts in there, I'm starting to feel like Bruce's trauma. really effective. It's horrible, but it's incredibly effective.
And the horror movie stuff. So again, James, I think this is probably... So Ang Lee was talking about how he kind of wanted to track the broad strokes of how Hulk had been viewed in the comics. So he wanted it to kind of start off as a horror movie, and he wanted it to start off as more Frankenstein.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of, you know, go along the arc of what Hulk had represented in comics as he gets further in. And I think that I do think in that first half of the movie, it effectively gets that, and I love the Danny Elfman score.
Which
is apparently directly Bernard Herrmann influenced. It wanted to be kind of Hitchcock in San Francisco, but more horror-y vibe Hitchcock.
I definitely picked that up. I was sitting there going, like, why is this scored like a Hitchcock film? is interesting.
But also because it's Danny Elfman, still feels superhero-y enough, I think. I think it's a great score. I love it.
Yeah, it's very good.
It's a
good.
Unique score, yeah. I don't love it. I don't think it's bad. It's rare that I notice scores on film. So the fact that I picked it up at all suggests that it's good.
Okay. We'll take that. We'll take that.
One element of this movie that we've not discussed at all, and I personally think for good reason so far, is the Josh Lucas of it all.
Oh.
I was about to say, are you going to say Glenn Talbot?
Is that who he is?
Yeah.
Is he a comic book character, James?
In the comics, Glenn Talbot is like a low-ranking general/lieutenant, maybe? I don't know. He's some sort of...
Oh, is he an Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. character?
He was played by What's-His-Face from Heroes and Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yes, yeah. Adrian Pasdar, yeah.
He's like a mid-ranking military officer. Who is an antagonist. And in this, he turns up and he's nothing like the character, and is just a dickhead.
Mm. I do like how the minute he shows up, it's like, oh, there's a douchebag waiting in reception.
Yeah.
Like, it's you're never uncertain of what we're doing
he
with
is,
that guy.
He's a bit 80s villain, because he turns up and he starts going on about how you geeks don't know what you've got on your hands, like, you want to stay poor all the time.
Right, well, now we're into why I like it, because it's clearly a Cobra Kai Karate Kid kind of a thing, yeah. And this is my milieu. I'm happy.
He's a villain, but a villain that's coded as... He is not actually a threat, and he will get his comeuppance, and it will happen well before the end of the movie, because...
Yep.
He kind of feels like a shit version of what Sam Rockwell does in Iron Man 2.
Yeah, I feel like he should end the film by being bundled into a police car while he rants about how, like, someone else is the real villain.
I do like that they put him in a plaster cast on a neck brace, though. I'm quite on board with, like, that level of... Like, that's so clearly... Yeah. I know exactly visually what we're doing with this guy. Him hobbling over... They have to speed up the shot of him hobbling over to drill into Hulk's neck because he can't hobble fast enough to do the pan with him and it not be boring.
Yeah.
Oh, I like that moment where Hulk's face literally kind of bulges.
Yeah, that's the thing, actually. This has got the incredible growing Hulk, right? This is where the more angry and upset he is, the bigger he is.
Because in that first sequence, he is less... He can fit within the corridor.
Absolutely. Yeah, his elbows brush along the edge.
And you see him, after that first fight with Talbot in Banner's house, when he walks out onto the street, he kind of bursts out of more of his clothes and grows a couple of feet. I liked that. I did like that.
I remember Empire printing a size chart when they did the behind-the-scenes piece for the movie. Of like, he's going to be different sizes all the way through, up until the finale.
But Talbot,
I feel like that's quite an interesting...
Yeah.
There's not a lot you can do with it. He's bigger, he's smaller. But it feels appropriate to the metaphor they're trying to wield.
Hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And again, I think it is like... It's that anxiety growing rather than the anger. So when he bursts out of the house, it's because he knows that... I mean, Talbot's not the reason he's just Hulked out. He's just, again, the catalyst. The reason is he needs to go and save Betty.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's when it grows, is when he goes, right, I need to go and stop these dogs.
Even that, again, going back to just the hulkiness of it, there's a very clear thing of Betty in trouble must go there.
Yeah.
It reconciles the superhero-y stuff maybe a little better than I'd realised. At least in, like, individual fragments.
We're not succeeding if you are appreciating it more and James isn't.
I know.
I think we're not succeeding if we realise this stuff in retrospect. If we go, actually, or maybe that scene did make Hulk a superhero. You didn't feel it at the time, though, right?
Well, the thing is... There's a thing with emotion. Just because you felt it doesn't mean you articulating it in the moment. That's always a bit retrospective. When you leave a relationship and you start to look at when exactly you stopped falling in love, you don't really notice that at the time and articulate it. It's okay to have only emotional responses to art.
Yeah, I think if it had pushed the right buttons, you would have felt it properly at the time rather than sort of intellectualizing it after.
I think my thing is I do feel, which is why I like the movie, is I feel like I got a superhero-y Hulk from it. I just didn't realise that I'd, like, was looking at specific fragments of that. Because I like the dog scene, and if you ask me why I like the dog scene, it's like the think through of it and the blah, blah, blah. But actually, it must be also, because there's this... It's that King Kong quality. I talked about it earlier without enunciating it. I like that he picks her up and feeds her into the car to try and protect her.
And also in the Hulk scene, you get to see his bum at the end.
Oh, yeah, which is always... Yeah, I mean...
That scene was going to be Hulk naked for the entirety of it.
This is... One way or another, this has been a movie I've rewatched. I mean, there are definitely MCU movies I've rewatched with less frequency than this. Because there's something about it I really, really dig. And it's quite nice. It's quite nice to talk to somebody who doesn't like it, because obviously the world doesn't like it. Like, it's not. It's not well regarded. It's not well remembered. It's not much talked about anymore. It's certainly not much of an influence on anything. I think everybody said at the time, okay, but maybe the editing will be the thing that is the influence that this movie leaves. And in fact, the closest thing you have to that is stuff Edgar Wright gets to do.
I was about to say Scott Pilgrim is the only one that comes close.
Scott Pilgrim is the one, and Scott Pilgrim didn't make any money either. And in fact, there's a definite argument that this Hulk gives you a sort of idea of what Edgar doing Ant-Man would have been like. At least in as much as, like, oh yeah, there's a reason Marvel won't tolerate that kind of shenanigan. It's because it's a Brechtian alienation device, or, you know, whatever. I feel bad for Scott Pilgrim, because it's a very good movie that nobody went to see.
Yeah.
But there's definitely an argument of, like, too much of a clever thing. Because it's
that's where I have got to with Edgar Wright as his career has progressed. I mean, to the point where we got to The World's End, and I was like, I get it. You foreshadowed all of this.
Yes, yes.
It wasn't interesting when you foreshadowed it, and it's not interesting now.
Oh, it's a whole other podcast. But it's like they aren't jokes. If I only know they're jokes the second time I round, the foreshadowing are jokes once you know what the ending is. Once you know there are payoffs to all of this, the first time it happens is really funny, which gives you a rewatch value, but I don't want to rewatch it because there didn't seem to be many jokes the first time.
And we get back to why this movie doesn't have a rewatch quality for James, but it does for you.
Yes.
Which is just, it's just that initial emotional reaction. I completely understand it, because, like I say, I kind of feel like I'm right in the middle, where I don't know whether it was just I'd been teed up by hearing some of the kind of critical reassessment, because it is out there that this is actually a good movie, and, you know, it was made by Ang Lee, and if the vast majority of his other movies are good.
Yes, he probably didn't just do this one for the paycheck.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I was kind of teed up for looking for interesting stuff in it. But I reckon if I'd have seen this, you know, 10 years ago, I would have completely written it off.
I had such a good time with it right from the first go. And that's the thing about those reactions, isn't it? If you really take to a thing, if a thing is clearly made for you, you can add a star and a half to the review score.
Or in my likewise, case, can take one off.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I can't argue that that's unfair or unreasonable. You're wrong, but it's not unfair or unreasonable.
But I also think there is something about how superhero movies have progressed and become not uniform, because I don't think they are uniform, but there is something about what we are used to be having delivered through superhero movies now. 17 years on from this film.
Oh, you only have to look at the origin of, like, the scene where Ultron gives birth is given birth to, is like one of those moments where you literally see the genre expand, and it just goes, oh, you know what, you just throw a load of stuff in a box and hit it with a magic hammer and you've got another one. And it's kind of fine. Nobody balks at it. Nobody goes, wait a minute, what? Now that is the growth of the genre that Ang Lee didn't have at his disposal, so ended up doing, oh God, am I going to have to explain the green colour and the fact that it's really self-healing and that it's bulletproof and all of this kind of stuff. And actually, you didn't have to do as much explaining as you actually did do. But there was a thing of, like, we are obliged to make this all track. And eventually we just went, comic book movies, it's kind of fine, everyone's okay, because the outcome's worth it.
Yeah. But I look at this movie and I go, it's what superhero movies have become. Not even that they've just aged it badly, but they've made audiences even less likely, superhero audiences, even less likely to go back and visit this and get something out of it.
Yeah.
Because it's not conforming to anything that we expect from superhero movies, much more so now, even than back then. And I also kind of think it's interesting that we, within kind of discussions about superhero films, there are lots of people who say, like, fans of the genre, and, you know, you hear, like, you know, it was the selling point for DC at one stage, wasn't it, that this is the filmmakers get to come in and make films at DC, and and Marvel, it's just any old director, and, you know, it's just churned out.
Yeah, they value storytelling. We can talk about that.
But I do think you get, obviously, you know, the Zack Snyder movies feel like Zack Snyder movies. I think that you can probably, it's less than half of the Marvel movies, I would say, that feel distinctly.
Oh, and as someone who doesn't buy into auteur theory particularly, I'm quite happy for these to parallel coexist. You know,
yeah.
it's quite lovely to go, yeah, go on, you know, you give me your massively weird take. Meanwhile, I'll let the writing department be in charge of some movies as well, because I quite like writing.
But I think the people who would say we want more director-driven superhero movies, I think what they mean is not Hulk. And I think if you actually gave it to filmmakers and gave them the amount of scope that Ang Lee got here, you would have a lot more movies like Hulk that audiences would completely reject.
Yeah. Well, that's the danger of the high wire act, isn't it? Is how
more
often
ponderous superhero films.
I mean, we were talking off mic about Star Trek and Bond and all sorts of franchises, and those are the ones that, like, what's it, Andrew, to get back to your Kickstarter.
Oh, yeah.
Bond is a franchise that everyone's like, Christopher Nolan, one day, surely. And they go, no, they're not going to give it to Christopher Nolan.
Imagine a Bond movie full of flashbacks. It would feel immediately unusual. It would part of your fight or flight response would kick in and go, what the hell's this?
And I cannot believe that they will ever make the Quentin Tarantino Star Trek movie, because that's not a thing that you do. Because it would, like, not at that budget level. It just doesn't happen. And I don't know who is the closest to getting the amount of leash that Ang Lee got on Hulk, but it hasn't happened for a long, long time.
Now, I mean, you're into your Zack Snyder's, aren't you? I mean, that's where it's...
I think that's the closest.
Yeah, and look how well that worked out for DC. So I imagine probably not going to happen again, right? I mean, in fairness, Birds of Prey as well, Suicide Squad, like, they gave them the chance to do their direct-to-leg thing, and it has not paid off even slightly.
No, this is true.
But I don't think that those two are anywhere near as close to... I mean, like, I think David Ayer got that movie completely taken away from
think the movie they took away was a better movie.
No.
Like, I am intrigued by the Snyder Cut. I have no doubt that I will not like it, but I'm intrigued by it because Zack Snyder is, for all of his faults, a weird and interesting filmmaker. I don't tend to like his movies, but I am interested by them.
Yeah.
No interest in ever seeing the Ayer Cut. No, thank you.
No.
Because
actually, you know what? It's going to be James Gunn's next Suicide Squad, isn't it? That's the one that's going to feel like a James Gunn movie.
Mm-hmm. But I kind of feel like within the restrictions now that didn't exist for Ang Lee.
Oh, certainly, yeah. But the nice thing is what he's essentially going to do is give you What If Guardians, but nasty. There's going to be a definite, like...
doesn't sound appealing.
And it sounds like we're going to get...
I have no idea what I think of it. Honestly, from the stuff we've seen so far, I must be the only person who left with no opinion.
And it sounds like we're going to get a link back to this Hulk movie and that the villain is going to be starfish themed. I can't remember what it was. It was some Starro, who is
yeah.
an intelligent alien life form resembling a giant starfish,
yeah.
Who uses spores to control people. And I think that actually might be Taika Waititi, you know. I think everyone's assuming that Waititi is...
The shortcut to likability.
Yeah, there you go. So that... there we go. We've linked back the new Suicide Squad movie in a couple of ways to Hulk.
There we go. We've proven that the 2003 Hulk movie is contemporarily relevant. I promise.
And we have finally talked about everyone in the cast now, I think.
Yes, no. I think we've talked about Hulk nearly enough. I think we should just probably round up some final thoughts. I will say that I enjoyed a brief cameo from Daniel Day-Kim. Who goes on to be Jin in Lost shortly after this. And can I just say, when he has been popping up in stuff recently, and that dude is aging like a fine wine. Mm-hmm. he is so handsome. So that's my little lusting after actors corner of this podcast.
Hanging out with Stan Lee. Yep.
Yeah, doing his Stan Lee. Yeah. Aww.
Yep.
I like it because they made sure he was in a uniform that really showed you his shape.
Right?
Good for them. Quite right.
Apparently
too.
That was completely improvised by Stan Lee. That Ang Lee just went, just walk and talk to him. Just be talking like two guys. And that's what Stan Lee did.
Do you know what? I would almost believe it, except that he gets Bruce Banner's current name correct.
Oh,
he calls him Dr. Krenzler.
Oh, Krenzler, yeah.
Which, like,
Dantzler
I don't believe
was,
he paid a huge attention to the script. I think that was written for him.
At the best of times, Stan Lee can't get his character's names correct, so, yeah. Probably fair.
Maybe he just took a guess and they failed to pick the rest of the film around what he came up with.
They were like, we can't get Stan Lee to do it again, so we're going to have to reshoot this bit of the film.
Doesn't Farino play... security guard at Berkeley in...
He does, yeah.
In Incredible.
Yeah. I think they're all of a piece.
More evidence of identity.
This character goes on to become Professor Hulk. And you can't persuade me otherwise.
Fair enough. No, I'll allow it. I'm totally up for that.
Phase zero.
Yeah, absolutely. One of my other favourite moments in the movie was Hulk literally biting off the warhead from a missile.
Oh, isn't that great?
And spitting it at a plane. I loved it.
He's having some real fun in that. I love him rolling up a sleeve he doesn't have when he's fighting the tanks.
That's my favourite action scene is the one out in the desert. Yeah,
that stuff I think Marvel Cinematic should be downright jealous of some of the Hulk stuff that's going on in this movie, in that middle section.
And it's, for me, like I say, I don't love the dogs. Agree with James, can't see the action sequence at the end properly. Definite big win for fighting the planes.
Yes, absolutely.
That is classic Hulk business as well. Like, punching some military gear. Very good. Happy with that. Doesn't do so much of that in the MCU.
No.
And then, at the end of that sequence, comes a moment that is going to be completely ripped off by Iron Man, also 5 years later, where the plane flies super, super high, and then...
Yes!
We
frosts and then over.
Hulk starts to freeze and then drops. And that's what Iron Man does, A, on a test flight, and then B, when he's fighting Obadiah.
Mm-hmm. Yes!
Listen, Ang Lee really was phase zero of the MCU. You've got that dead on, James.
And cool. we didn't do the joke about his name once, which I think shows admirable restraint.
Which was all that anyone could talk about at the time.
I know, it was on every bloody pull quote. Oh.
Stuart Lee really had the last word on that one, I think.
Yeah, that's true. He's driven that all the way in.
Yeah.
Do we like, by the way, do we like the you wouldn't like me when I'm angry ending?
Sorry, I'm just aware. I think when you said name, I was thinking Banner, but you were talking about Ang Lee angry,
yes,
weren't you?
I was.
I was as well.
Both of them remarkable.
Yes, a lot. There's a lot dropping into place right there.
Yeah.
But yeah, what do we think about, because I know it's the TV show, but him off in South America doing good and subtitling his catchphrase worked as a nice little sign off for me.
I'll be honest, I didn't care at that point.
I think
it's just me that's going to love this movie.
It's,
I don't
it's bold
care.
Of the movie to save its one joke to the very last second.
He spit out a warhead. Not all the jokes are dialogue.
All of the interesting stuff had wrapped up, and then the movie continued for a couple more scenes.
That's fine. You know what? I don't mind. I don't mind being the only one with this movie. If there's, listen, by the way, if there's anyone listening to this who's on Twitter and is with me on this movie, come and tell me. I'll feel so reassured.
I am half with you. Yeah. But I just, again, I want to read a book interpreting this movie more than I want to watch it again.
Well, you want to watch his commentary, which I totally understand. In fact, I would do a commentary of this. There's another one for Kickstarter. I'll do a commentary over this movie. Somebody actually, I've already promised my editor that at some point we'll do the essay, analysis essay on Short Circuit 2, which, as you know, wow, is a particular thing of mine. So we'll just add this to the list.
Do Hulk first.
It's great. I love this collection of movies that everyone dislikes that I'm determined to redeem. Quantum of Solace, Hulk, Short Circuit 2.
I mean, I liked Short Circuit 2 when I was a child. I've not dared watch it since.
Yeah, well, there's one very specific thing that make it very hard to watch. In,
like the, what's the guy who plays Ben, right?
Yeah. Fisher Stevens
it's
is very
Fisher
much
Stevens,
not,
yes.
not of a descent that is appropriate to the part he is playing.
It was a different time. A different time. It was the, 1980s.
Yeah. Yeah, nobody knew it was wrong is the argument, right? Isn't it? Nobody knew. I mean, it might be only white people didn't know, and that was enough. That was the thing.
Yeah.
I've segued us quite appallingly. I apologise.
Traditionally, when we start talking about other movies, that's when we know we've hit the end of this one. So.
Yes, probably. This is.
I think we have well and truly talked Hulk. I enjoyed it. I really enjoyed
we
it.
We smashed
well,
Hulk.
That's good.
Okay, so Andrew, thank you for joining us for our Hulk chat.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
Where can our listeners find you online, and where can they find out more about funding your Quantum of Solace Kickstarter?
So I'm Ellardent on Twitter, Ellard, Ellard, and then ENT at the end, Ellardent.
Which is how everyone reads it.
Yeah, everyone reads it as Ellard Entertainment, whereas it's supposed to be Ardent, but with a little more Ellard, but... whatever, I'm fine. Listen, it'll do.
It's like Hulk. You won't get it when you first look at it, but when you think about it,
it's got layers. It's got real layers, like an onion. The Kickstarter. I mean, go to Kickstarter and put in it's video notes. So it's spinning off from the tweet notes series that I do on Twitter. So it's video notes for James Bond. But obviously, I'll be linking to it on my Twitter, and I'll be linking to it from andrewellard.com,
my
website.
We will link to it from the Cineverse Twitter.
Oh, you diamond geezers.
Well, brilliant, Andrew. Thank you for joining us. And listeners, if you enjoyed this episode, then you can find out more and subscribe on Acast, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Player FM, Overcast, Google, Stitcher, or your podcast app of choice. You can find out more about everything we do at cinematicuniverse.com. You can find merch at cinematicu.redbubble.com, and you can get in touch with us on Twitter at @cine_verse, or send us an email at podcast@cinematicuniverse.com. You can also find us on Patreon if you want to back us further. Thank you very much for listening, and we will see you again in a couple of weeks.
Bye.
Goodbye.